Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome. Well, maybe I should do a mic test. Am I coming through okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, November 20th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 515-604-9386. Our participant code is 419-303. If your cell provider blocks or charges for the call, you can call our backup number, 781-838-3728. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find our banners, their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please consider supporting NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Tonight's scripture reading is, we're going to pick up where we left off, Matthew chapter 20, verse 1. We're going to read through 19. 20, 1 through 19. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers in his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again he went out about the sixth hour and ninth hour, and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle, and saith unto them, Why standing ye here all ye day, all this day idle? They say unto him, Because no man hath hired us. He saith unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. So when even was come, the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his stewards, Call the laborers, and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. But when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more, and they likewise received every man a penny. And when they had received it, they murmured against the good man of the house, saying, These last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden and the heat of the day. But he answered one of them, and said, Friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst not thou agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? So the last shall be first, and the first last. For many be called, but few are chosen. And Jesus, going up into Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way, and saith unto them, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles, to mock and to scourge, and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again. Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 19. Okay, let's see. I guess the big thing right now is the sheriff's project. We're very, very close. Carl, are you here? Can you give us any insight on that? I know Carl's been working trying to get things going for tonight, but I don't think we're actually ready yet for... I'm sure Carl will pipe in if we are. I don't believe we're ready yet to start to receive donations or anything there yet. So we're still working that out. But people can go out there to take a look, take a peek. It's powerofthecountysheriff.org. Let me repeat that. powerofthecountysheriff.org. Again, the purpose of that site is for the sheriffs and trying to really get knowledge into the sheriffs to have the necessary knowledge and, that they need, really, that they should have had. Matter of fact, all of us should have had this knowledge. But anyway, that, of course, is the purpose of the website. We've got the book completely done. I don't know if the latest is up on National Liberty Alliance yet, but you can get the very latest, and I'll make sure tomorrow or maybe tonight I'll get the latest up onto our website, National Liberty Alliance. But you can go up to the power of the county sheriff and get the final draft, which we're sending out for final cost to see where we're at, what kind of monies we're going to need to be able to order the necessary number of books to get 20 to each sheriff, plus some, you know. And hopefully that project's going to move along quick. It's going to depend up really to all the people listening right now, how involved they're going to be in letting others know about this website. We're going to put, matter of fact, let me open up that website for right now. Okay, up on the website, you know, it's all really focused in on an education, of course. The news is very interesting. It's all focused in on sheriff stuff. And, you know, some of it may be a couple of years old, some of these videos, but it's news, and it's as valid today as it was a couple of years ago. So we have a lot of good stuff up there. We have a lot of law documents. We've got books and biographies. We also set up a link for the committees of safety. We're going to make a connection for that, but we do have all the information for people to be able to go out and create committees of safety. We're going to be offering the free courses that we've offered here at National Liberty Alliance. I know they're not up yet. That'll probably be the last thing we'll hook up. There are other things that take priority to that. We're going to have a page for Q&A, particularly for sheriffs, but anyone can ask a question about the law or about which is the Constitution, of course, or anything concerning the website itself, you know. So that page, people will be able to go out there, ask a question on a form, and we will respond to that answer within 48 hours. We also are going to build Liberty Coalition. We're going to create a page. I haven't talked to Carl about this yet, but we're going to create a page where other Liberty groups can come up and sign on in support of our project, and they will be listed, or when they sign up, they'll automatically be listed onto the page. It'll be done in alphabetical order, and they'll be able to post their organization name, the state and county, or if they're national, they'll have the opportunity to put down national, and give us a link of their website, and we'll link over to their website, and we'll ask them in return to put a link on their website to link over to the Power of the County Sheriff website. So that's something that every one of us can get involved with. We could take it to our own Liberty groups. If we have websites on your Liberty groups, we can make the exchange. Or people can go out and get in touch with other people that they know belong to other groups to try to get them out there and do the same. And so we want to really get as much support as we can. We want to try to bring all of as many Liberty groups as we can together. Any Liberty group that has a website that we do hook up and connect with and share links with, we'll probably look and investigate somewhat on them. I mean, we want to make sure that nothing is radical there. But in any event, that's kind of part of our plan. Our directory will be the directory of all sheriffs that are involved with, you know, what we're doing and taking and making use of our the education we're offering them. And this will be a great opportunity for people who want to start a committee of safety to see if their sheriff is hooked up into this already, or vice versa. Maybe a sheriff, because we're going to train the sheriffs about coalition, about the committees of safety, and they of course hopefully will be interested. And if they don't find and connect with a committee of safety themselves from, you know, their perspective, we can potentially pass names and numbers of people in their county. course, we'll give them a call to make sure, you know, that they're active and willing to work with the sheriff to do what needs to be done. But anyway, that directory will be posted. And the only, like I said, the only people on that directory will be sheriffs. Nobody else will turn up on that that page, with the exception of, you know, a representative for that website, which at this point will be Jan. His name and number will be up there, and his email. Matter of fact, Jan, if you're here, I think I created a new email for you. We got to talk about that from Power of the County Sheriff. Pretty sure I've done that already. But in any event, if not, we will do that. And then, of course, we'll have a donation page. And so we need as many donations as possible, especially in the beginning. We want to really pump as hard as we can to try to get that, you know, our project going and get 20 booklets to every sheriff out there. Anybody out there that's got some deep pockets that looking for a worthy cause to donate to, well, this is the worthy cause. I'm sure if you take a good look at this, you'll see this is definitely a place we want to invest our time and our money in. Just imagine sheriffs having the knowledge and the true knowledge of what a real warrant looks like, a warrant that requires a sworn statement, which is an affidavit. It requires an affidavit. So whatever it is that they're looking to do to seize or to, you know, look into your home for some item or something, there's got to be someone who swears to having firsthand knowledge of something in that case for a search. And of course, for a seizure, you know, the IRS seizes all the time. They won't be able to seize anymore if the sheriff is educated and understands that, hey, without that wedding signature, number one, from a judge, and most importantly, a sworn affidavit, which they will never do. IRS will never do a sworn affidavit. They never have, and they never will, because that would be too chancy for any individual taking that chance to put their John Hancock under there with a sworn statement that something is owed when it isn't. So that would be a thing of the past. Just imagine that. IRS, a thing of the past as far as coming to seize your property, as far, and also these raids that they have, especially done by the IRS, that wouldn't be allowable no more, because the sheriff will understand that before an outsider, particularly a federal agency, comes in, they need to notify that sheriff that they're coming in, and that sheriff has a duty to make sure that they stop at his office before they execute that warrant or maybe even be out there, and that would be, of course, the ideal thing. But look, if that warrant isn't in order, if there's no sworn affidavit, if there's no wedding signature of a judge, that sheriff's not going to let him go. So those will become a thing of the past, and that will deal with a lot of federal agencies. The power and the authority of the sheriff to bind together and deal with a federal agency, maybe like takes place out west, you know, with the, oh goodness, what was the name of that federal agency? Anybody remember that? I don't know why I'm drawing a blank on that. But anyway, BLM, that's it. Bureau of Land Management. Just think of the fact that non-judicial foreclosures will be a thing of the past. Can't happen no more. Why? Because they can't do it legally. That's why they're doing it illegally. And the sheriff can intervene on a phone call. Okay? And the bottom line is the sheriff's got to do the final business of taking that property. And without the proper papers, without the you know, due process proven, without a warrant signed by a judge and a sworn affidavit, it can't happen. Same thing with tax foreclosures. Okay? Just by giving knowledge to the sheriff, those areas alone are huge. That's most of our problems. Of course, it's not all of our problems, but that's most of our problems. And it extends from there, giving the knowledge to the sheriff that they desperately, desperately need. We do believe that in the book that we put together, and if you haven't read the book, you should read the book, which is the Sheriff's Handbook. We have a copy of the Sheriff's Handbook. If you go up to that site and click on Books Bio, okay, right there, very first thing Maybe it's not here. Maybe it's on, oh no, it's on Law Docs. That's it, Law Docs, I'm sorry. So you go to powerofthecountysheriff.org, click on Law Docs, and it's the very first handbook, the very first link there. Click on the sheriff's handbook link, and it'll open up a PDF. You can save that to your computer. But everyone could read this. And what we endeavored to do in this book is to, in the first page, really capture them. Okay, you know, the index, the front page is something that should be drawing, but of course there's the index, a couple pages of an index, and then the preface. And within the first page of the preface, we believe that we've accomplished our goal of giving certain amount of information that should really draw the sheriff in. I believe the preface is about 5 pages. And if they read through the preface, I do believe that they'll be drawn into reading the whole book because this it becomes clear that it is their power. I mean, I'll just read the first paragraph or two. The purpose of this pocket handbook is to fully inform the American county sheriffs, deputies, and bailiffs as to their authority, duty, and the law. This handbook is an endeavor to concisely and completely cover the aforesaid in a topical style to make it easy for reference. We also created a website, powerofthecountysheriff.org, to further expound on the topics within this handbook, provide a further education, offer 2 free online courses, provide many pertinent documents, provide pertinent information, provide for a national platform for communications among the sheriffs, and offer authoritative advice, in short, a proper education. So anyway, that's kind of the beginning of the book, and I think these 5 pages really kind of should draw them in. Any sheriff that is really looking to do his job well, any sheriff, and most sheriffs feel inadequate, they feel uneducated in the areas that they know they should be, but they don't know where or how to get that education. That's the problem. You know, we all should have that education. We all should be taught these things in school. It's called, you know, really just studying the Constitution. But we haven't got that. We don't get that knowledge in school. Sheriffs become sheriffs, and they have no education, proper education. Yeah, they have maybe a law background, maybe a military background or something. But generally speaking, they have no law background at all. Okay, they have no understanding, and the only thing that they're taught, especially if they have a background in law enforcement, I might have said law before, but I meant law enforcement. They may have a background in law enforcement, but if they were taught anything there, they were taught about statutes. Statutes have nothing to do with the law that we're talking about, and you know, especially the statutes that the law in, that. Police enforcement, or law enforcement, they may call them, has those statutes really control our behavior, which is null and void and unconstitutional. I believe that this book, when read through by anyone, but particularly the sheriff, as they read through, will come to a conclusion that first of all, that they'll be a little confused. You know, why have they thought that things were this way, but clearly it's that way? We have so much authority in this book. Everything we speak and bring out in this book has authority connected to it. It cannot be taken away. And yet what they think they know has no authority. And any sheriff that reads through this will become very clear that that all of these statutes that control us are unconstitutional. And of course they're going to have to spend some time struggling to work this out inside their own mind before they start to really develop a backbone. And more they read, the more and more of a backbone I believe they'll develop. And especially if they start communicating and organizing with other sheriffs, they will empower each other. They will assist each other in building backbones, so to speak, because that's what they need. They need to be able to step up, stand up, and apply the law and protect the people. And protect any individual whose unalienable rights are being violated. So this book is really, really important. This project is really, really important. And just with what I said concerning the IRS, concerning tax foreclosures, concerning mortgage foreclosures, concerning SWAT coming in with breaking down your doors on a warrant because you know, maybe you owed a school loan that you haven't paid back. That's not a joke. That's a real case. Turns out that the person who was supposed to live in there wasn't even living there, and they knew it, but they broke down that door anyway. They frightened the children of the house. They violated everybody's right and in that house. And those will become a thing of the past. When you're being assaulted on a highway by some trooper, you call the sheriff, and you'll get protected only by a sheriff who understands his power and understands his authority, what the law is and what is required of him. And of course, it's against everything that I've ever been taught before. So this is a really, really important project. This project alone literally can save America. Just by preventing the federal government from having their way with the people throughout these states that they've been having their way with for a long, long time. Now, of course, we're still working with the committees of safety, connecting the local people with their sheriff and letting them, on the grassroots level, take care of business. We'll give them as much information, as much education as we can. As anybody been listening in, you know that our instructional handbook up on the Committee of Safety page. We have an instructional handbook. I forget how many pages, 40, 50 pages or something. I don't remember. But it's quite a few. And it lays out very specifically and precisely on how to create a Committee of Safety and explains what it is and what are the major focuses and where you end up at the end, which really is taking back the political process. That's what the Committee of Safety is all about, bringing the political process back to the people on the grassroots level and getting rid of those people who are controlling it up on the high federal level, actually even behind the curtain, so to speak, there. Of course, our main project that we're working with is administrators for the grand jury and also the trial jury. Only the people should be orientating the people, bringing them the true law. And it doesn't take much for people to realize what they need to be doing as a jurist. But, you know, we get 6 hours to 8 hours, you know, we get a day, administrators, to really orientate the people, preparing them for that job, making sure they understand what jury nullification is. Right now, you'd be thrown out of a court, the courthouse, if they hear you talking about jury nullification. It's like pulling out a cross on a vampire, you know. But anyway, jury nullification, extremely important that jurists understand this. They need to understand that for every injury, there must be a remedy. If the person is found guilty of something, well, who is the injured party? How are you going to make that person have a perform a remedy for the injured party? You know, that is the real job of the jury, and the grand jury, of course. You know, you can't go after somebody for their behavior unless it injures another individual. You know, so statutes are not something that could be applied against the people. Statutes are written for bureaucrats, for the elected individual, for the appointed individual, for the general employed individual working for the government. That's what statutes are for, and of course for commercial processes in use that we've given the Congress power to take care of in Article 1, I believe Section 8. So I really hope that everybody really appreciates and understands how important this particular project is on the sheriffs. And very soon, I think probably this week, we'll get out the word that everything will be operational and that we need to really start focusing in on this. We might even call for we might even call for a special meeting during the week concerning the project once we get it launched. But if it's close to the week, well, this is a holiday week, so we probably won't. So scratch that, holiday week. We will hopefully by next Monday be able to really be, you know, in full force here and really get into focus and details on this project and really get things going. We're looking to bring people together to make phone calls first to our membership. We have over 6,400 members at this point in time. We need to call those membership, every one of those people, and we need to let them know about this new project we have and how important it is, and ask them to go out and take a look at this website and read the purpose of the website, which we found on the front page, and help participate in the education of these sheriffs, and for them also to go out and find people. We need to get everybody active. You know, the people we phone call and get in, you should all ask them, you know, to volunteer their time to make a few phone calls a week through our membership. And then eventually when we exhaust through our membership, or even at the same time, we can be going out to our local communities, our local liberty groups, getting them out to the website, understanding what exactly our project is all about, and get them involved. And we need to raise an awful lot of money very quickly. Getting 20 books in the hands of 3,000 plus sheriffs could be slow going, because I know it's going to be around 50, 60,000, somewhere in that number. And if it takes us a year to collect that kind of money, you know, we will then be sending, you know, ordering small orders of books, but it'll cost us more to order, you know, small orders. But small order of books, getting them out to sheriffs, and then again, more, ordering more, mailing them out, more, mailing them out, and so on, until we accomplish our goal of getting these booklets out to every sheriff in America. That could take a year, could take 6 months, could take a year. But if everybody hits it, if all of National Liberty Alliance memberships alone, just our membership alone, if everyone in National Liberty Alliance were to come and give $10 a piece, one day we'd have all the money we need, $60,000, $64,000 to be precise, minus whatever the banking cost and exchange and stuff. But that's quite a bit of money. That's quick. Okay, that could be accomplished if we can get everybody's attention to realize. Look, at everybody who signed up for National Liberty Alliance signed up for a reason. They saw something here. And I'm sure a lot of these people have forgotten. We need to remind them. Refresh their memories, get them back out here, and then understand the power of this project we have going with the sheriffs. Maybe there's some people out there with deep pockets and can throw us $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. Get a couple of those people and pow, literally overnight. If we can collect the $60,000, which is rough, we don't have an exact number yet, but if we can collect the necessary amount of money in a month's time, let's say, we literally can have these books in the hands of every sheriff in 2 to 3 months. Bear in mind, it's going to take, it takes about 4 weeks to order the books, have them printed, and then they set it out. They have to wait a period for drying, I think. But in any event, I understand it takes about 3 weeks between by the time you order it and the time they're actually delivered. You know, it's got to be put into go to press, and then it's got to be pressed, and then it's got to sit, and then it's got to be shipped. So if it took us a month to get the money together, if we were able to get it that quickly, and it took us another month to receive the booklets, maybe it'll take us another month, because, again, that's minimum, unless we can get a lot of more. If we can get some people to volunteer, otherwise, you know, it pretty much my family be working on that, maybe a few people that I know. And we'll just get these things packaged up and mailed out to every sheriff in America. We can probably accomplish that in a week or two, maybe. I know we've sent the things out to the sheriffs before. We've sent things out to, all the sheriffs before. That project took us quite a while. I think it took us about 5 days to pack all the mail together and actually get it out. And anyway, we plan to move as quick as possible, but we can only move as quick as the money flows. And this is really a project everybody should be looking at. So, okay, let me see where we're at here. Jan, do we have any announcements or any questions or anything?
Yes, I have a couple. The first one I'm going to go through, even though I haven't really finished it because I haven't had time, but it concerns this DOD exercise that was conducted on October 24th. All members of the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, which I'm a member of now that I'm a ham, and so I got a notice that there would be this exercise on October 24th, and it stated that the elements of the U.S. Department of Defense, or DOD, were conducting what they called a communications interoperability training event on November 4th to 6th. And I put some information on that in a newsletter at that time. And that would simulate a national massive coronal mass ejection or an EMP or an electromagnetic pulse, which will shut down all of the traditional communications, landlines, cell phones, satellites, and internet activity and other services. Now, they initially intended to crash the grid, shut the whole grid down throughout the country, and they later thought better of that and just simulated the failure. Now, during the exercise, they had a designated DOD headquarters entity and requested county-by-county status reports of all, and they call it 3,134 U.S. counties, so their count is within one of ours, and county equivalents in order to gain situational awareness and to determine the extent of impact of the scenario. Now, the Army and Air Force MATS organizations will work in conjunction with the amateur radio community, primarily on the 60-meter interoperability channels, non-internet-linked amateur radio repeaters. Now, they've done this before, but they say again this year, a military station on the East Coast and at Fort Hayayuca, Robert will pronounce it better for me, HF station will conduct a high-powered broadcast on the 60-meter channel.
It's Huachuca.
Huachuca, yeah. Thank you, Terry. I knew you'd know, too. That was on the 5.330.5 kilohertz band. And it was to be run on Saturday from 3 to 3:15 UTC, which to me, an old-timer, is Greenwich Mean Time. It's 4 hours different than ours. New this year, they say, will be an informational broadcast on Sunday at 13.4835 megahertz, upper side band from 1600 to 1615 UTC, or for me, that's noon to 15 minutes after noon, since it's 4 hours behind. Now, amateur radio operators should monitor these broadcasts for more information about the exercise and how they can participate in this communications exercise, the announcement said. We want to continue building on the outstanding cooperative working relationship with the ARRL and the amateur radio community, they said. We want to expand the user of the 60-meter interop channels between the military and amateur community for emergency communications. And we hope that the amateur radio community will give us some good feedback on the help of both the 5 megahertz interop and the new 13 megahertz broadcast channels as a means of information dissemination during a very bad day scenario. And it looks more and more like we're going to have some very bad day scenarios, whether we have a coronal mass ejection or not. So I think it's a time for people to pay attention, and if they don't have an HF rig, consider getting one. Now, I was unable to listen in on a Saturday call, but on Sunday at noon, I called in and listened on their designated channel. And I listened for 20 minutes, and it was long past the 15 minutes after noon, so I started scanning other channels, and I ran across a Mars channel that was on 5.33 megahertz, roughly, by Alpha Alpha Romeo 3 Delta Echo, and located in Delaware. And he was a Mars Channel master op. And this is a channel that normally would be used in the northwest of the country for that whole sector, so it was clear channel here in the east. Now, he went through calling for information from all areas within hearing, and he would come up with different areas. They'd call in singly, and they'd give their call sign. From that, you can look up through the internet and find exactly who that was and where they're located. And I found it interesting because that way I could get somewhat of a test on how my HF system is working, so I can see what kind of coverage I got. Now, the questions they were asking and wanted answers to were six things. And this was a response from that person concerning their county. The first thing was, do they have power, electrical? The second was, do they have any communications? The third thing was, do they have water? The fourth was, do they have sanitation? The fifth was, do they have medical services? And the last one was transportation. Is there transportation running in that area? Now, they got responses from various places while I was listening, and I didn't listen that long because I had other things to do. But Akron, Ohio, Delaware, Rockingham County, and I haven't had time to look up where that person was located, what state Rockingham County's in, and Wilkinson, Ohio, and there were several in New York State. So I can go back now and plot out what coverage I had that day. Now, we have finished on the ham calls going through the ARRL manual that covers everything you need to know to become any one of the three grades of hams. And it's time now for people to step up and at least get the capability to do reception, receiving, on HF. It costs a little more than the Bofangs. With the Bofangs, we can run UHF, we can run VHF, and with that, if they take the time to look up their local repeater, there are generally repeaters located fairly close together. For example, in Pennsylvania, we can cover essentially the whole center of the state. That's about a third of the state with one system, with a series of repeaters that are all interlinked. I know Terry has the same thing out in Colorado. So if you have a Bofang, you can get information from that sector. If you have an HF rig, then you can tell that repeater system what's going on. Somewhere in the loop, somebody has to have an HF rig, or a number of people have to, so that they can feed information into UHF and VHF bands where the little Bofangs can pick them up. So I would like to make a case for people to consider at least getting a receiver. You can get computerized software receivers, which are not that expensive if you want to go whole hog and buy a good HF rig. You can spend upwards to $1,000 for a good transceiver and antenna. And that's about all I wanted to say on that. Now, I had some comments from a newbie member about the sheriff's manual that I thought were worth bringing up. Really, it's one comment. He looked through the handbook, liked it, thought it was great. He had one recommendation, and I tend to agree with his assessment, having done things of this nature in the past. It would be nice to have a one-page executive summary at the front, very front, of the document, with probably with bullets, with the highlights, and maybe a little page number or something after him to tell the sheriff where to go to look up any particular thing. So you'd pull out maybe six or eight topics that are in that whole document, put them on one page with bullets. And that seems like it's worth considering. Now, moving on to questions. I have a number of questions tonight, John, so get ready.
The first is,
I read that in the current grand jury process, a unanimous decision from all members is not needed to indict. but it does need a supermajority of two-thirds or three-quarter vote for an indictment, depending on the jurisdiction. Is the same true for the common law grand jury?
Yeah, pretty much. You need to have, let me think about this. I think the grand jury can whittle down to a minimum number, and I forget what that is. I'll have to look that up. But the grand jury must have majority, and majority is will get the indictment if that's what the, you know, it is. That's that. What we're doing is national, and we usually have quite a few people that come on for, you know, to take a vote on the grand jury, and it's usually very close. If it's not, it's usually unanimous, but sometimes we get one or two people that might disagree, but generally speaking, it's pretty much everyone agreement. And I think that's impressive, especially if you have 50, 60, 80, 100 people coming. I mean, we used to have as many as a couple of hundred people coming in the beginning. Not so much anymore, but I think the last time we had it, I think we had something like 50 people, if I recall. You know, when you get 50 people agreeing on something, you got an indictment. And of course, we're looking for at least 50% to get an indictment. So that's kind of what the rule of thumb, because we're not operating, with the 25. We're operating with much more than that. And we have to, because we're state. We are, hang on a minute. You know, we're many, many states, and we have to, just want to shut my phone off. We're many, many states, so, you know, we're coming from 50 different states coming together, and so we're going to have a lot more people involved, and what we're dealing with only is subversion against the United States by enemies both foreign and domestic. We're dealing with these people who have taken control of our judiciary particularly, and others, but right now we're focusing in on the people that have betrayed us, and they are servants in our judiciary process, and yet they think they've become our masters and are abusing us with their power, and much of it they don't really have. But because we're so ignorant, we believe that they have, they get away with it. But anyway, is that the whole question?
The first question. The second question is someone who has filed a civil complaint in the Massachusetts Federal District Court for a declaratory judgment for quiet title and declaratory judgment for treble damages for violation of the False Claims Act, and he filed that about 9 months ago. The judge has remained totally silent, and he is a pro se litigant. His question is, if he would be within his rights to file a show cause into this case to force the judge to either rule on the case or provide cause why he has not.
Well, absolutely. Look, if he's done something like this, there must be some process of time that things need to be done in. And so he's got to look up that. And then, of course, at that point, focus in on whatever rule that might be. What was the original case for? It's for a
quiet title.
Quiet title, and it was something else.
It was just a declaratory judgment for treble damages.
Okay. Yeah, you need to put, the judge needs to do what he's got to do. I don't know what the allowable time is. I don't know, Brent, if he's there here and can unmute himself, maybe he knows. I'm sure you're talking on the federal level, right?
We're
talking
say.
On the federal level?
Doesn't say.
Okay. All right, anyway.
It does say Massachusetts Federal District Court.
Okay, so you should be able to find something in the rules on this.
Yep.
But a show cause is definitely in order.
Okay. Next question then. Can a defendant in a federal court declare after a court-appointed attorney has pleaded not guilty on behalf of the defendant, and the defendant has hired a private attorney to prepare a defense, can the private attorney at any time declare that this is an Article III court of record in order to preserve the defendant's constitutional rights?
Yeah, if he'd like to keep his license, he can't do that. But if he doesn't care, he can do that. I think I might be serious about that. You know, lawyers are not going to be able to talk like that. That's why we have to defend ourselves. They can't sanction us. They can't shut us up that easy. They don't have a license to dangle over us to say, you know, you keep behaving like this, we're going to pull your license. So they can't beat us up like they beat the attorneys up, and that's why they have them totally under control. So any attorney that comes to the truth and starts to break loose, they're going to find the wrath of that court upon them very quickly. And I'm sure by the time if they do come to terms with what the truth is, they'll already know that, because they will have been observing what's been going on in the courts and know that the courts are unjust. Look, all these people, in my opinion, are guilty. The lawyers, the judges, all of them, because they all know what's going on. They all know the game. They all make, in the back room, they make their deals and play the game. And they just screw everybody else that's coming in the court. Anybody that thinks that their lawyer thinks of you first, that's representing you, well, I got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you, because his first order of business is to be obedient and work with the judge. Okay, that's his first order of business. And that's that. So.
Okay, the next question. I've heard you speak of a court of record. Are all federal courts a court of record?
Any court that has a jury is a court of record. No jury, not a court of record. There may be one exception with that, and that would be the United States Supreme Court. They themselves are a full jury in themselves, and they are of record, and they are, their decisions ultimately guide control all the federal district courts, and the Constitution gives them that power. There's only one United States Supreme Court, and all federal courts answer to them. So any problem in those courts, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has the power and the authority to make a correction and overturn any decision and make it right. Of course, if they go the wrong way and make it the wrong way, we the people don't have to obey that, because we can make it null and void. A trial jury can turn around and go whatever way they want, and no Supreme Court can overturn the decision of a jury, with the exception, of course, by the rules of the common law, where someone is found that their rights are violated. It's got to be an unalienable right violated by someone, by a decision that the jury might make. So there's not much for overturning. The United States Supreme Court has ruled many, many times already on this issue, and has said that their decision is final, and it's as if this court had made it. There's no second-guessing on it. It's final. It settles the matter altogether. That's why, it's very hard to take a jury trial and take it to any kind of an appeal process, because usually the issues brought up are issues that cannot be overturned. Again, they have to find an issue that really where the jury, by their decision, and somehow violates some right of someone. So.
Okay, next question. How do one of we, the people, file a grievance against the government with the grand jury?
How do one of we, the people, file a grievance against the government, what?
With the grand jury.
Well, look, it's difficult. We're trying to get a foothold in the courts to begin with. So we're working diligently on that by building pressure and adding more and more cases. What was it they said it was seeking?
They had a grievance against the government.
Grievance. Well, you know what? Again, a grievance, we have a lot of grievances. We have to start with the major one, and that's the fact that all these juries that they've got going are stacked juries. They're not free juries. Every one of them has been spoiled. And that's both on the grand juries and the trial juries. So that's where we have to start off. Grievances, we've got plenty of grievances. And I was thinking of doing something on that kind of thinking, but maybe we'll talk about that in the near future. Right now we have to really kind of put some effort back to where we're at. We need, I was thinking of going after Jeff Sessions, but there's a lot of things out there, don't know if it's true yet or not, that Jeff Sessions is doing his job. It's just the way that they're, you know, him and Trump have been really working things, so to speak. But I don't know how true that is. We'll find out soon. But we definitely have to deal with this magistrate that has not made a decision or made any corrections in the court case that we're in. We're going to do a show cause to him. And we might even do something in the court with this other judge that's been sticking his nose into the court, Khan, Judge Khan. I wonder if he's a con himself, you know. But anyway, convict too. But anyway, I'm thinking of doing something with him. So, you know, we're going to discuss that and figure out what kind of paperwork we might want to do on him. We have sent papers recently into the court. He sent us a paper not long ago trying to make it clear, do not send any more papers in. They're not going to be accepted or something. I forget exactly the stupid words he said. But we sent papers in. We made it very clear with a file on demand. We told the clerk, look, if somebody wants you to break the law by not accepting or refusing, then, you know, you're going to be held liable on this. Let him. We told the clerk that they should file it. Let the judge take it out. If he wants it out, let him pull it out and send it back to us. They haven't sent any of these papers back to us. So they're still taking our papers, and the only one that's kicking and complaining is the judge who we indicted. So.
Okay, last question. Are U.S. Supreme Court decisions rulings or opinions?
U.S. Supreme Court decisions?
Yep.
Well, that's a good question. To some degree, they are rulings, of course. They are decisions, okay? And, you know, they can be overturned by another Supreme Court. But remember, that doesn't affect the people. What we have to realize is, you know, if you're going into a criminal case, okay, those court decisions don't affect those cases, ultimately speaking. To some degree, today's environment, maybe they do, but they shouldn't. Because every case is unique on its own. Jurists don't know anything about Supreme Court rulings. They're not governed by that. They're governed by the heart and the mind, okay? You know, that which is right, to do the right thing, to do no harm themselves, of course, and really make a judgment when you bring 12 people or more together to really sit down and figure out what took place and if there's someone in the wrong and what has to be done to fix that person and so on. Those 12 people, I think, will generally almost always do a good job. If they're free, as long as they're not tainted and they are free, and they understand their power and authority, both on law and on the guilty or not guilty, the facts, both on the facts, law and facts. A jury that understands that is free. So they're not really governed by the Supreme Court rulings, per se. Remember, the Supreme Court rulings are really dealing with cases where the judge's decisions are in there, not where the people's decisions are, where the judges are. And if you're dealing with a criminal case, and that's where your concern is, where all of us should be, to make sure if we ever are charged with something, that we do get a fair trial, we could be very safe there. When you get into the contract side of the court or the trust side of the court, now when you have a judge up there making the decision, you know, you have an appellate system, an appeal system. Unfortunately, it's all corrupt, so it's very hard. If you're going up against the status quo, against the government or anything, it's going to be real hard to get anywhere with these judges. And that's going all the way up the line. You might have some, you know, very few cases get to the United States Supreme Court anyway to begin with. But if you're lucky enough to get up there, you might get a good shake up there. But generally speaking, you know, it doesn't work out too well. But remember, anything over a $20 value, which would have been a 1 ounce of gold, but it's $20, you can call in for a jury trial, and that makes it a court of record, and none of these courts can overturn that, unless, again, somehow the jury's decision violated someone's unalienable rights somehow. You there?
So that was the last question, and I don't have a report from Robert. He's unable to be on the call tonight, so that's all
okay.
That I have.
All right, Gerard, you got anything? Hit the button, Gerard.
Hit the button. Hit the button. There's so much stuff. I don't know where you start. I mean, this whole country is like self-destructing. But it's been self-destructed for a long time. And there's a report put out, I think, by Catherine Austin Fitz about they did an audit using the information, the government information. And what they've discovered is there's $22 trillion missing since 1969, which is like our deficit just went up to $21 trillion. It's like $69,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. So this is all money that's gone into the deep state. It's gone into God knows what. It's gone into fighting, you know, taking our rights away and them living lavish lives and all this pedophilia. So I don't know what we're going to do about it, but it's huge and it's definitely documented. It's not a if, and, or but. It's actually a fact. So now you have this government that, you know, for over 50 years hasn't been following the Constitution. You know, they're supposed to file reports on what they're doing. The only thing that they can keep secret is military stuff that has to do with national security. And this far, far out does any military budget. It's many, many times everybody's budget, even the Department of Justice. So, you know, technically, we do have reasons to break those bands with this government. We really do. And I think that we have to start asserting that. Look, they've gone so bad for so long that we're no longer going to play their game. You know, I mean, they're going to have to start ruling for we the people. And you know what? I want my $61,000 for all my kids and wife and everybody in my house. Where's my money that they stole, you know? So that's the story. It's just another story. And also, they claim that this ex-operative in Hillary's camp was, you know, he turned whistleblower, that he testified against her today. She tried to have him killed. He survived the attempt and redoubled his effort. Well, supposedly he testified against her with everything that he knows. And another guy on Thursday that was due to testify against her.
Is this in Congress, before Congress, Gerard?
I think it's the Department of Justice. I don't think it's Congress. I don't know who's ever doing the investigation.
So these are depositions, or these are any idea on what
I think it was whatever that commission they put together. I don't know who they're testifying. Let me see here. I have the article. Let me see if it says. Let's see. I don't have it here. See if they give me a blurb. Yeah, well, it's not in a court of law, because somebody's saying, why is this testimony not run in a court of law? So it's probably in front of Congress. So, you know, and really, that's damning to Congress. I mean, they have, at this point, if they don't do anything about it, they all need to have their feet out of the fire.
Yeah, this should be before a grand jury.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, that the Department of Justice needs to do that. They need to, get either Sessions has to do it, or he has to do a special prosecutor. the trouble is, if they have somebody like Mueller do it, that's a joke, because he's in it right up to his neck. You know, how can he do anything? It's ridiculous. It's so ridiculous that this guy got so deeply involved in the corruption that was done by the FBI and the NSA and all that, and had firsthand knowledge. He's a treasonous himself, and he's still there. I don't get why these people are still there. That's what I don't understand. I think that the people need to start raising hell and raising their voices. I think Donald Trump needs help of the people to because look at whether he knows it or he doesn't know. If he doesn't know it, if we raise our voices to it, he will know it. But even if he knows it, he can't be the guy running up the hill with his sword out. That's us that push him up.
Well, you know, it could be, and again, you know, I don't want to say that anything like this is really happening, but I do hear a lot of things are going on that we don't know about, and so we got to be a little patient. But look at whatever evidence is coming up before Congress or in some kind of a judicial setting of some kind, I don't know. Well, Jeff Sessions or someone needs to be there, I'm sure, and that's information. Look, it's almost like a deposition at that point. Questions are being asked, answers are being given, and witnesses are giving their testimony, what they know, and this is all stuff that could be brought to the grand jury. It's just a matter of collecting all this data and all this information and bringing it before a grand jury. And there is a possibility that this is happening as we speak, but I don't know that we want to speculate too much.
Well, the other thing is it's so deep and so broad that you can't, you know, it's like cancer. If you go in and try to cut it all out at once, you kill the patient. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. You're going to create a vacuum. And the other side, they don't care. I mean, part of their strategy, I believe, was to have this all revealed so that the country would be in a state of shock. A lot of people all those people that work for them, they always throw their people under the bus. That's how they operate. You know, whenever the communist, socialist, or whoever take over a country, they always do a purging and kill the people that facilitated them coming in. That's their method of operation. Because let's face it, they don't want them there. They can't trust the people that just threw their own countrymen under the bus, so they get rid of them. So I do believe that that's part of their strategy, and the government, Donald Trump and whoever's working with him in the military and wherever, they have to be careful, because they'll use this as a scenario to make confusion and chaos, and that's what they want, because then they can lock down and step in and put in the controlling government that they want. And so we're in very interesting and trying times right now, because everything's going to be liquid here in a little bit. So that's where I think National Liberty Alliance, as a steady voice, and filing what we file. See, they don't want our paperwork. I know for a fact that Donald Trump sent word out that he wants people to document all this stuff. You know, so that it's coming from the people. And look at it, one of the best ways to document it is to file it in the court. I mean, that's one of the reasons they always wanted to throw our paperwork out to begin with. They don't, you know, they don't operate good in the light, and they're not used to this. They're not used to people pushing back, and so they're really not good at answering it. They're used to having just carte blanche to do what they want, and so they're actually at a big disadvantage right now. And so we need to keep moving forward. We need to keep filing our stuff. We need those affidavits are very important, you know, putting those affidavits in. And we need to think creatively, because at some point I think we should start running cases against the government for some of this stuff, that the people need to come up and file cases and say, look, I want answers. I want, you know, we know that these things are facts. You know, the evidence is out there now, and it needs to be fixed. It needs to be addressed, and we have a right to that. And we also have a right to fire you and get rid of you, or just completely throw you in the can and start over. And look, there's a lot of people calling for a constitutional convention, because they have to get rid of the Constitution in order for this to work. As long as the Constitution is written down, and as long as we say that it's our rule of law, they can't get away with what they're going to do, because what they're going to do is so egregious, it violates every tenet of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. So their main thing is to get rid of that. So you watch and see what they're going to do here in the next couple of months in order to accomplish that. Thank God we have a group of people that saw this coming and have been watching it from years ago. And believe me, I do believe that Donald Trump knew all this stuff years ago. I read something today that he was a John Birch member. Now, the John Birchers, they were made to look like kooks, but they were the ones that came up with all the conspiracy stuff, and they pointed the finger at the Trilateral Commission and what's the other one that they're all in, that agency there? I'm drawing a blank. Not only the Trilateral Commission, but there's another group that they all meet. Not the Bilderbergers, that's another one. But, you know, they outed those organizations 50 years ago, and everybody said they were crazy. They said McCarthy was crazy, a communist on every bed, and it turns out that they were laying the plans back then. And certain people in government and in the know have been watching them, and they've been planning. And I do believe that this election was the final straw that they implemented the plan that they had worked on for many, many years, over 30 years, 40 years. They watched what was going on, and they said, okay, now we have to do it, because we had somebody like Hillary in there that was so horrible if she would have got in with the fraud that she was doing. So I don't know how much of everything he knows, but if he was a John Birch member, he knows, oh, the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, that's another big one, you know, in conjunction with the UN, United Nations. So this stuff can all go away overnight. All we have to do is implement the Constitution. That's all. It's very simple. We don't have to reinvent the world. We don't need any new laws. As a matter of fact, we need to get rid of some laws. And so it would be very easy to fix it just by telling the people in their counties, and I do believe it has to come from the counties, to start following the Constitution in everything that they do, everything. Because they're all violating it, because all that garbage that's up on the top, it flows downhill. When they're stealing and doing this and that, the lowerlings quickly learn about it, and they want to please their bosses, but they also take the advantages just like the bosses do, because those are the guys that set the tone and the tenor for things. And so if it's all fast and easy and, you know, all this crazy stuff that's going on, it doesn't take long for the lower people to figure it out. But you see, if you fix it at the county level, that really gets them, because that's ultimately what is the main thing that our rights are in. It's property rights. And that's what Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, it's all about, us losing any ownership of private property, and we lose our voices. We're not allowed to own anything. We're not allowed to, you know, I mean, just think about it. In the beginning of this country, you couldn't vote unless you were a property owner. So if they take all the property, guess what? You're not going to vote either, I guarantee it. Not that they haven't had the voting lockdown all these years.
Well, they already have all the property. I mean, goodness, you're paying taxes on your property. Paying the taxes in some places is like paying rent. It's so high.
It's worse. It's terrible. But the thing that has got us this far without us falling is the perception of freedom. They told us we were free. They told us we had this Constitution. And that's been their biggest obstacle. You know,
that's why the Sheriff's Project is so important.
Absolutely.
And I'll tell you what, you know, these Sheriff's books is not just knowledge for the sheriffs only. It's for every one of us. We should all know this stuff.
Well, yeah. And the thing is if we know it, we can bring it into the meetings, into your town hall meetings, into your county legislators meeting.
Right, we can get sheriffs. You know, we could make another handbook, which would combine the jurist handbook and the sheriff's handbook. You know, the jurist handbook I'd like to redo. I mean, not too much, but I'd like to put in a little better format. More like the sheriff's format, which was close format anyway, but I'd like to change it around a little bit. But, you know, if we can take the sheriff's handbook and the jurist handbook and do, which really go hand in hand anyway, but we can combine it in a way and make it a handbook for the Constitution or something for the general people. We'll have to think about that. But we probably should get a handbook that combines everything together. But the sheriff's handbook alone is powerful. I mean, just hand that out to people.
Yeah, and the
jurist handbook.
And it kind of mirrors a lot of it, you know, because you're talking about the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Right.
That's other elected officials are affected by that.
Well, that's where I'd like to focus a booklet towards those people. Okay,
right.
Because we do have the people's handbook called the jurist handbook. And we got the sheriff's handbook called the sheriff's handbook. I think we need to get one for the elected individual. What is necessary for them to know to hold office? And, you know, we need to do some research, which we plan to do, and I'd like to get it going now if people anybody wants to get a committee going. But do a research on all of the different levels of offices on the county level, the state level, and the federal level. And of course, the town, local levels. You know, what are the offices that are available? Let's name them. What are their powers and their authorities? What's their main focus? What's their job on this office or that office or another office? Do these people in this office have the ability to appoint certain individuals? If they do, who do they get to appoint? What commissioners or whatever the case may be? But every office, we should be able to really you know, describe what it is and what's expected of the individual who wins the race for that office, and then we can really focus on a book directed towards the elected individual when we understand ourselves and the knowledge of what it is that they need to be doing, and I'm sure a lot of these people are doing things outside of their power and their authority, and we got to be able to define that. So if anybody has this kind of knowledge or would like to dig up this kind of knowledge and work with us to develop this. This is something we should start right away. So anybody wants to create a committee and get this going,
John,
give a call to Jan, and we'll move along on it.
I'm going to give you a kickstart on it. Years ago, I came across this book my mother had, and it was called The Republic. I thought what I did was, it was falling apart, it was old, and I sent it to my buddy, the printer down the road, and he printed me some copies, and I thought I gave you a copy. And in it, it has the breakdown of how a republic operates, right from the president through all the departments, right down to the dog catcher, because the separation of powers was well defined. I think we've lost that. I think it's like you said, these people are not operating within the scope of their definition of the republic, of what their authority is. They're far exceeding that, you know. So that's very important, and I think
now say you've got some kind of a book that has started this kind of information.
It's an old book. It was what they used to teach the kids in school. They used to know.
I remember you talking about that.
I gave you a copy. I'm pretty
I don't think so.
It was.
I remember you talking about
it. It was not a book. It was the book that was taken apart, and it was printed, so it was on 8.5 by 11 pages. So, and I thought I gave you a copy, but I recently ran across it here. I have to dig it out again.
Well, and one of the things we could do, you know, we can get a hold of old books like that, be great. But look at, even through Google itself, we can get a lot of information historically, you know, what is the makeup and authorities of a particular office. And we can run that information one after another and research it and create a, you know, sort of a, some kind of a chart that lays this out. Because look at, we the people generally don't even understand, you know, what these offices are and what they're supposed to be doing and what they're not supposed to be doing. We need to know. If we're gonna govern ourselves, we need to know when they're not doing things or when they are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. We need to know. And then we can correct. And, of course, that's what we're working on with the jury system. We will correct all these problems. But, again, we need to know. And you know what? The people being elected need to know and understand. And they also need to know that we know. So don't step out of line. The other thing, of course, is look at Who are these people that go into office and they don't know anything about the Constitution? They don't know the Bill of Rights. They don't understand American history. They don't understand where America really is and how we got there and how serious a problem we, dilemma we're in. You know, they need to know these things. And, you know, our civics course really deals with a lot of this stuff and how we got where we're at and where America should really be and American history. And, of course, our constitutional course helps with the Constitution. But these booklets are really, really powerful. We need to write a booklet for the elected individual, generally speaking, and cover the bases of all and create a website. Well, look, at National Liberty Alliance, you know, we're at some point in time we're going to get more focused in on the political side of our structure. You know, we have the two powers. One is the political, one is judicial. The people need to control them. We control the political by controlling our who goes into office and who doesn't. And the rule for those people should be, how well do they know the Constitution? Do they know the Constitution? We should be asking them constitutional questions. And when they fail answering those questions, we should tell them, come back when you know the Constitution. Until then, we're not walking for any of your signatures. That's what we need to do. And of course, on the judicial side, we have the power and the authority through the grand jury and the trial jury. We decide yay or nay whether we're going to allow an individual to be indicted or not. And we get to decide on whether someone is guilty or not and what really needs to be done. And jail is not the solution. For most things, jail is not the solution. You know, something violent, of course, we have to deal with that. And all those people running around in black robes, we need to deal with that too. So I guess we have enough jail cells for them.
Well, look, just think of how fast the country would straighten out with just one little item. If they stopped tainting the juries and the grand juries and people could rule on the law, everything would get straightened out just with that being accomplished. People using common sense, common law, natural law, knowing the difference between right and wrong, when something doesn't seem right and it's not right, and they could rule with their hearts after they listen to the evidence, it would be light speed, I think. I mean, look, they spent so much time getting into the schools and dumbing everybody down. There was a reason for that. We're reaping that. We're reaping what they sowed for us right now. But the people will catch up quickly. And one of the first places they have to catch up is in the juries and the grand juries. And I think we've got to be very insistent that that's an area that we make sure that the minute the judge, the prosecutor, or anybody in that court tampers with that jury, that they are swiftly and severely dealt with so they don't dare even think about it. Because that's what's going to put this country back on track. It's we the people in our juries and grand juries indicting and convicting or whatever we got to do to pass out that justice.
This is the administrator's job. I mean, this is really one of the major points, really, is to watch the courts as much as orientate the jury. And you know what? Keeping that jury open to the public. Anybody wants to come talk to the jury, anybody who wants to come talk to the grand jury should have the ability to make an appointment and come in and see the grand jury. You know, of course, you want to get a general idea what they want to talk about so that you can, you know, give them only so much time. They don't waste the grand jury's time. But the bottom line is everyone should have that opportunity. And you know what? If people had access to the grand jury, then guess what? The administrators of the grand jury and, you know, we the people in general will know when the crime is being committed, we'll know when a jury is being tainted. We will know when a judge has abused the court process. We'll know all those things. Why? Because the people we're coming and telling us. Because this is their system. This is how we the people rule and consent to being to our rulers. And I wouldn't call them our rulers, but our servants, shall I say. They act like our rulers, but they should be acting like our servants. You know, it never ceases to amaze me whenever I go into any government office anywhere. I mean, as long as you stay on the planned conversation that they're expecting to hear and respond back to you, things go fine, but you ruffle their feathers in any little way before you know you're surrounded by cops. And that's no exaggeration, no exaggeration at all. This has happened to us many times. They come and they try to intimidate us. They don't want the conversation to go outside of their control. Well, we need to turn that around. The people's conversation needs to take precedence. And they need to answer. And they need to stop acting like our masters and acting more like our servants.
Yeah. Okay, that's
okay.
It for
we'll
me.
We'll move over
Thank
to Brent,
you.
I guess. Brent, you here? I know I saw him there. It looks like he's here, so we're going to go to Brent. I see his mic is open. Okay, we're going to go to Brent Winters. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com, and Brent is going to teach us something. Brent?
That's funny how you put it. I'm going to teach you something. I'll tell you what I found out, and take it for what it's worth. I enjoyed all the discussion thus far, I usually do, and all the comments, especially about the radio, the ham radio, if that's the right word, I don't know. I've probably told this story before, but I have a family member who is now deceased who was taken prisoner in Germany during the last World War, and nobody knew what happened to him. His wife was beside herself for 30 days, and finally she got word from a ham radio operator who was monitoring the Nazis' radio communications, and he had learned through that monitoring that he had been taken prisoner and he was okay. Well, he wasn't okay. He was beat up pretty bad, but he was alive. And he got word to her long before the government ever got word to her. And that's the way it always is. We have governments because there's some things only they can be allowed to do. It won't work any other way. But even in those cases, they do a very poor job. The question isn't whether government is qualified to educate children or to fight wars or whatever. The question is government qualified to do anything? And the answer is affirmatively no. They are not qualified. They can't be trustees of property. That never works, by the way, because what belongs to everybody belongs to nobody. That's what's going on out with that BLM property and the whole Bundy situation. And every trust lawyer who's worth his salt knows that the government is not a trustworthy trustee. Ask any American red man who knows the history of his own people whether the government can be trusted to keep their word. Of course they can't. That's impossible. One member of Congress or one member of the executive branch gives their word, and then they're out of office, and somebody else comes in from the other party, and everything the government had promised before goes out the window. That's the nature of government. Let's grow up and say, okay, we get it. Government can't run business. We don't expect them to try to run business like a business. It's not a for-profit organization. That's not going to happen. They're not trustworthy. Let's keep them confined to a very tight jurisdiction, national defense, and justice. In other words, they'll maintain courts. And whatever the Constitution says, oh, there are a few other things, maintain post offices and post roads, but that doesn't mean they're to have a monopoly on delivering letters like Congress says they have now. All of these things come back to the limit of government. If there is no outside force whereby men perceive that government is limited, government will be unlimited. It will be total, as it was in the German state during the Second World War. It was total because they recognized no outside power whereby government would be limited. And according to Carol Quigley, author of that for a long time hidden book called Tragedy and Hope, mentor of Bill Clinton at Georgetown University, history professor and a good one, I might add, but a left-wing, wacko, New World government promoter. He jumped the gun. He wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. In it, he revealed the plans of the evil empire to take over the world. You can still get, well, I shouldn't say still get the book. You can get the book now. For a long time, you couldn't get it. But he's a good historian, although he was fundamentally twisted at his foundation. But he understood facts. He had them right. And he analyzed the German people and why they did what they did. Of course, that's what he wants to do. Amazingly, he's gone now. That's what all these minions of evil want to do. They want one world government. He said this about the German people. He said after the disintegration of the Roman Empire, the German, he called them the tribal Germans. That's what they were. The Anglo-Saxons, by the way, at one time were part of that. He said they looked around and they saw the disintegration of their own people after the Holy Roman Empire fell apart. As Gibbon says, it was neither holy, nor was it Roman, nor was it an empire, but it controlled the German states. It fell apart. They didn't know what to do. They were disjointed. They didn't have unity. And they turned their eyes toward what Rome once was, and it intrigued them. And what intrigued them was the totalitarianism of it, the machine-like precision, the claimed precision of it all. And they fell for it. In World War I, and even more so, they fell for it in World War II. Rome, the civil law, the canon law, the precision, the government by one will, they loved it. They said, this is the thing that will enable us to take over Europe. And so they gave all that power to Adolf Hitler, and then they tried to take over the world. But Napoleon, the Frenchman, did the same thing. He was from a family of civil law lawyers, law of the city lawyers. And he wasn't even a Frenchman. He was a Sicilian, Italian, of the Sicilian brand. He somehow had the persona that appealed to totalitarianism. Rule by one will, by one man, they fell for it. They said, this is the answer. It isn't the answer. It's the doom of a nation. Look at France. Look at Germany. Look at what France has fell for now. A little pervert that was an art major in high school or something, and he had an affair with his teacher, and they kept him up with designer drugs ever since, and now he's running the whole blasted country. Actually, he's nothing but a minion for powerful bankers. Is that what we want? Well, that's the way we're going. This looks like. But I'll tell you for sure, I ain't going that way. I've made up my mind what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do, and I hope you've made yours up too. And I hope that there's a critical mass of us that made up our minds that we're not going to go for that totalitarianist baloney. And just hold the line. Hold the line that government is limited. There is an outside force whereby government is limited, and what is it? It is the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. The laws of nature is his will, and the laws of nature is God written. The laws of nature is unwritten. Verse 15, let's see, what have I got here? Paragraph 15 of our Declaration of 76, speaking of King George in England, but he was emperor, he claimed, in the colonies. He is combined with others. That's called a criminal conspiracy, by the way. People say, you're a conspiracy theorist. No, you're a jackass because you don't recognize, a brained one, I might add, because you don't recognize that conspiracy is the name of the game, always has been, since the founding of the city of Babylon 4,300 years ago until today. Evil men have combined together in 100,000 million different ways to try to take over the world. Well, that's what's going on here. He combined. That's called conspiracy. What is conspiracy? At law, conspiracy is an agreement, number one, to commit a crime, number two, and one overt act in furtherance of that agreement, number three. You prove that, you prove conspiracy, and you'll send people to jail. That's what prosecutors do. But he has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution. I've mentioned this before. Our Constitution, this was written 11 years before our Constitution was written. What in the world are they talking about? Well, they're talking about the common law, their common law, the law of the land, due process. Those three are synonyms. Our common law is not a law about, it's not goal-oriented, it's not object-oriented, it's not result-oriented, it's process-oriented. The law of the city is result-oriented. Our Constitution is process-oriented. What does that mean? That means it is due process. We're to concentrate on the process that is due and owing to all concerned. That's our Constitution. It's still our Constitution, due process. The most important right our Constitution, the United States written, mentions. The due process, as a matter of fact, our Constitution of the United States is a document of common law due process. That due process of government, for example. What it takes to make legislation, what it takes to make a court opinion, what it takes to set up a government. Not what is to be done, but how is to be done. How the relationships between the three branches, the three independent powers of government are to operate. Foreign to our jurisdiction, and I talked about the Quebec Act and the canon law up in Quebec and how they'd extended it down the Ohio River, all of Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, that was all Quebec. Quebec back then. By an act of Congress, but that encroached upon the Charter of Virginia. And Virginia said, oh, no, wait a minute. And they got so determined about it. Patrick Henry was governor of Virginia. He commissioned 165 men to go capture that territory back. And they went to Kaskaskia, Illinois, on the banks of the Mississippi, captured that fort. Then they went to Vincennes, Indiana, on the Wabash River, Vincennes, Indiana, between on the border between Illinois and Indiana Territory, and they captured that, and they took back all that territory that belonged to Virginia by charter that Parliament had said belonged now to Quebec, and the canon law ruled there. Well, that's what he's talking about here. It's called the Quebec Act, a foreign jurisdiction, unacknowledged by our laws, giving its assent to their acts, pretended legislation. The Constitution, I've mentioned that, is their common law, conspiracy, and agreement to commit a crime, combining with others. And the culprits of this conspiracy, these co-conspirators, paragraphs 15 through 24 of the Declaration, declare themselves, it says, invested with power to legislate, but they don't have. As does the Federal Reserve Bank in our own day. England's central bank, called the Bank of London, enjoyed monopolies on, number one, issuing currency, number two, trade using the East India Company, number three, and receipt, had a monopoly on receipt of tax revenues to service its loans to the government, just like the Federal Reserve Bank of today, and further, to fund enforcement of such taxation. And this was all contrary, in that early day, all contrary to the English Constitution's common law rights against monopolies. Our common law is intolerant of monopolies. Monopolies of force and violence, monopolies of issuance of money, monopolies of trade. And the only way monopolies can continue is by force of government. If government doesn't force monopolies, they don't exist. Free trade exists. And anytime you see a monopoly, just being government enforced. We have them in our own country today, number one, as I'd mentioned. The monopoly on issuance of money. That's government enforced. Boy, you even come just a little bit close to personally, by your individual actions, threaten the power of the Federal Reserve Bank. They'll put you in jail. Don't think for a minute that people that sell crack cocaine are in jail for selling crack cocaine. That's not it at all. They're in jail for using money to exchange for crack cocaine, an unauthorized use of money. I'm telling you, that's what it amounts to. I have good reason to know that. I don't care about crack cocaine except it encroaches upon the CIA's hopeful monopoly of drug trade. It's a matter of money. They're using money, a crack cocaine dealer uses money in ways that the Federal Reserve Bank doesn't authorize. That's why they go to jail. If they weren't using that money, they didn't intend to use that money for their drug deals, nobody'd care. Well, this clause, this is number 15, paragraph 15 of our Declaration of 76, it shows that not only did the colonists in that early day have a good constitution in their common law government, but also shows their zeal was keen to keep it pure from strange law pollutants of strange law, the canon law of Rome, the civil law, the law of the city, all the same, governs almost every country on the faces of our planet today. The Code of Justinian, the Code of the Old Roman Empire, it's all there. It's all total government. the colonial Americans' British brethren had the same zeal for our common law. Oh, yeah. People over in England, believe it, I lived, well, I'm not far now where I am here in the Wabash Valley from a place named after a member of Parliament that stood up in Parliament and made a speech in favor of the cause of the colonies. His name was Lord Effingham. Effingham. There were a lot of people in England that were against the war against the American colonies. On the 14th of November, in the year 1770, the London Evening Post included the following against an English judge. I'm going to quote this. This is from the London Evening Post, 14 November, 1770. And the writer of the Post said this: "In contempt of the common law of England, you," speaking of this judge, "introduce into the court jurisprudence unknown to Englishmen. The Roman Code," he says, "the law of nations, and the opinions of foreign civilians." Civilians, that's a Roman law word meaning citified persons, civilians. "The Roman Code, the law of nations, and the opinions of foreign civilians are your perpetual theme. But whoever heard you mention Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights with respect? By such treacherous acts, the noble simplicity and spirit of our Saxon laws were first corrupted." Now, this was written, he says, Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights of 1828 is the progenitor of our Bill of Rights of our Constitution of the United States. So we weren't the only ones. It was those in England that were profiting from the East India Company, which was the trading arm of the Bank of London. Our war for secession from Britain's empire was to enjoy our English Constitution, the same common law tradition the English demanded for themselves. In a word, our declaration says King George had conspired with the bank and trade monopolies to displace common law authority with the civil law's admiralty power. Well, I think I've spoken probably about enough this evening. Well, I'll keep going. There was a noise on the other end I couldn't compete with. If somebody needs to mute, I wish they'd do it. But I may say just a little bit more. No, I won't. I won't. The echo's too loud. John, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Am I coming through?
Yeah, you're coming through great. I can hear myself echoing. I probably ought to quit
for a while. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not hearing that. Jen, are you hearing any noise or Gerard? I'm not hearing the echoing or anything like that. So.
Okay, well, do you want me to keep? I wanted to finish one more paragraph, if I could.
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to say that the general government of the United States, the one sitting in Washington, D.C., is doing now as it had done then by overreaching, for example, the Admiralty Clause of our Constitution. And it uses admiralty law to control people and their property. Fundamental common law rights do not attach to matters within admiralty jurisdiction. There is no trial by jury. There is no due process. There is no warrants required for searches. That's true of admiralty jurisdiction. It is a martial law, a law of the city. Thus, government's lawful, unlawful use of admiralty law works to deny common law rights, such as the right to trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, and get this one, of course, too, the right to keep and bear arms. If admiralty jurisdiction is real, then all of these, jury, the warrant requirement for searches and seizures, and the right to keep and bear arms, aren't part of our reality here in America. Admiralty law, which is another form of civil law, the law of the city, is good when kept to its proper use to govern shipping, ships, and those activities in direct relationship to these. But it is downright dangerous when used ashore. that's a good stopping point. Thanks again, John, for letting me say a few words.
Okay, thank you, Brent. All right, we're going to take questions. If anybody's got a question or a comment, star 6 to get into our queue, star 6. We only got a couple of people in there right now, so now's the time to get in. Gerard, are you ready to take it?
Yeah, I also want to pass some new information out. I've been receiving some of these videos from different people, and this April by June is pretty good. You know, she put out that the Marines have taken over Langley Airfield Base in order to protect Donald Trump. Of course, there's a lot of people out there going, it's not true, but she's got some pretty good sources, ex-Special Forces and stuff. But she also brings up in this thing, you know, about a week ago, Donald Trump was giving a speech, and he opened up a bottle of water, and they all made a big deal about how he took a drink in the middle of the speech and all this stuff. And Newsweek ran this article that he used two hands on the bottle, and he doesn't know how to open a bottle properly and all this other stuff. Well, it turns out it was a bottle of Fiji water, which he turned towards the camera. I saw it. I didn't understand the meaning of it. Look, at Donald Trump graduated the military school with honors. And he's in the top 3% of people as far as IQ goes. He's a strategist, and he's playing strategy. The owners of Fiji Water are one of the biggest donors to the Clinton Foundation and the head of the pedophile ring. He was sending them a message that he's going to take them down. You see, that's what he does. And all the news could do is talk about how he shouldn't have been drinking and how his hands are too big to open a bottle and blah, blah. There's a Newsweek article that says scientific proofs President Trump can't open a water bottle properly. You see how they're trying to distract us from what's really going on? So that's what you're going to get with these regular news medias. All right, let me get to my board here. And look, that's a YouTube video, and it's called Confirmed, Marines Land at Langley to Stop Coup. And then / Hillary worried over indictments. Very good video. You should watch it.
I want to interject here. It's not Langley Air Force Base. It's Langley, the head of the CIA, just outside of Arlington, Virginia.
Okay, that's right, because she said that to lock the CIA down, so that makes sense then. Okay, very good. Hang on, just let me get back to my window here. Okay, I'm going to open the queue up. And
hello,
we got California Fred. How you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, that movie you were talking about, I saw it today. Or wait, last night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I followed up on the source and I read everything. And I wanted to... I bring it up to bring this other one thing up. They also had 1,800 and some odd sealed indictments go out as well.
Right.
That's something you didn't mention that's really worth it on a program that discusses law, at least in my opinion.
It's no wonder Hillary's worried. And you know, she's got to sit through all this thing as that shoe gets closer and closer. So... She deserves whatever anxiety it gives her, believe me.
And
you know what gets me is Jeff Sessions. Everybody is yelling and clamoring. Hannity, everybody's yelling, Sessions, do something. I think he's doing the smartest thing he can. He's slow playing him.
Well, I think he's running whatever strategy Trump did. And look, at Trump's smart. He takes the heat off himself and puts it on Sessions. That's what he should do.
And by the way, we are very much aware of these indictments. We haven't specifically spoken about them because we haven't got that confirmed yet. We're getting it from numerous sources, but nothing absolute. And we've heard between 800 to 2,500 indictments.
Well, they're mentioning them on Fox News, so I don't think Fox would be mentioning them if they couldn't back it up.
When did they start? because I've been kind of keeping an eye on that. I'm kind of surprised how much Fox News has been really bringing in the news, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was in the past 24 hours they talk about indictments going out. So I don't, you know, it's probably just a blurb. But it's out there. So what else, Fred? You there?
Yes, sir. I had a question about the Bundys and the trial.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have somebody who would come on and talk about that, and he hasn't given us an update today.
Yeah, we didn't get an update last week either, but we've been getting a lot of updates, you know, up until then. Matter of fact, I think we did have an update last week also. Is Ollie on board today?
Yeah, Ollie's here, I believe.
I don't know, maybe he's got something to tell us, but usually he would pipe in to let us know, so I don't know.
I guess everybody knows that Ryan was released, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that's kind of old news, but I don't know what was going on in the trial. The last thing was is the judge was making more concessions, and they were hoping that it would lead to a major decision, which I kind of doubt. I don't think she's ready for that, to let them all go, you know what I mean?
Well, do we have court watchers watching the trial?
Well, we have people like John Lamb that are in there every day that do videos. Their stuff is out there. I bet you Ollie knows more because he watches that stuff all the time. And
yeah, he had to hang up a minute. I don't know if he's going to try and call back in or not. I think he will.
Right,
so
right. Because
for him.
He could give us a good update. So if
I
we
do
see
have
him.
One question for anyone in NLA that might. Have you ever heard of a gentleman by the name of David Wynn Miller?
David Wynn Miller. Why does that sound familiar? David Wynn Miller.
Well, he's a mathematics genius, and he speaks many languages, and he correlated a mathematical formula so that he could prove the truth in a sentence where you could read from the back to the front to the back, the middle to the front or back, and it would mean the exact same thing. No sentence or word could be taken out of context. He maintains that wars are fought over language, the usage of words, and never over mathematics. So he tried to use his mathematical formula to create a syntax. And some of the stuff this guy has done.
Well, we are familiar with that, and we've been approached with that, and some of that has been explained, and we've looked at it. Personally, I haven't found any credibility in it.
Well, I'm terrified by it.
Why?
Well, what it generally means is, since everything, all the nouns have been changed into verbs, and
mm-hmm.
David Wynn Miller has corrected the Magna Carta.
Corrected the Magna Carta.
Yes, in what you would call now time syntax, not in future tense or past tense.
And yeah, but there's a mathematical formulas that he's using to do this, correct?
Well, the formulas he uses are based on verbs, adverbs, pronouns, nouns. All words in the dictionary are basically nouns. And by losing the article in the prepositional phrase, you turn a noun into a verb. His conjecture is that in the courtrooms of America, they use the word usage is wrong because they turn nouns into verbs, and it's some kind of copywritten language, and they can't understand the truth. So they speak in
who can't understand the truth?
The lawyers. Because they don't deal in the truth, they deal in the fiction.
Well, I think it's exactly why. They've been taught the lie. That's why they don't understand the truth. They don't understand the language of law. They understand the language of statutes. And again, you know, we did speak with this guy quite some time ago, and we didn't find anywhere where it went credibility that could be used. He was trying to get us to do writing in a mathematical fashion, and I don't know, it just didn't work. Look, we should be more concerned with the meanings of words that are being changed than some kind of a mathematical equation. Maybe there's something to it, and I'm pretty deeply involved in mathematics myself, but I just don't see it.
Well, sir, I
only... But that, you know, but again, I got to leave it open. If someone can explain it and give us some, you know, understanding of it that could really make sense, I'm willing to listen.
Look, it's the trouble with mathematics is it's a very right-brained operation. So if you're going to turn language into a mathematical equation...
Look, forget about the mathematical equation part of it. Just understand that the numbers represent... It's kind of hard to write the word adverb when you can use a letter or a number to represent the word adverb.
I understand, but what you're doing is
that's where the numbers come in. He uses the numbers to simply write down what kind of verb or adverb or preposition it might be, and he uses his numbers to chop up the sentences so he can read it properly in the right syntax to turn a document that's written in verb into noun, which makes it the truth. And he uses specific dictionaries, so you cannot mistake what he is saying. It eliminates interpretation of the law, where we're being raped by the Supreme Court right now today. Consider that. Now, I'm not trying to throw you guys a curveball or a bag of worms. I'm simply asking... You might want to take a second look at David Wynn Miller.
Again, we had this guy come and we had conversations with this guy.
Okay.
He didn't tell me, but maybe he can. Maybe he can't articulate it well enough. At least to me, he can't. And maybe if he wants to give another try, I know he felt it necessary for us to try to understand him. But
right.
Believe me, I didn't see anything that could give us any benefit here.
Well, I do.
Well, maybe we can meet with you and you can explain it to us.
I'll just do it right now. You'll get it in five or six words here.
Well, give it in five or six words.
Okay.
Basically, we're going to hold you to that now.
Basically, the UN has accepted his language. The United States is aware of it and has accepted his language. Now, the deal here is if all laws are written in the verb and they don't mean anything, that means if you write it in the proper syntax, you can tear apart all the laws in the country. There aren't any. They're false on their face, including the Constitution. That's what terrorizes me. There's no law. It's all written in the verb.
Well, we already know that without having the syntax understanding. I mean, I don't, I'm still lost at this.
Well, as soon as you start writing things in the truth, then you'd wrangle them in.
Look, there's no interpretation of certain fundamental principles. I don't care how you twist it, there's fundamental principles, and that's why we talk about natural law and God's law and using those things that come out of the Bible to guide us, because there is no interpretation of that. Look, murder is murder. I don't care how you verb it or adverb it or number it. There's no what is the meaning of is. That's Bill Clinton. And what you're saying is it's going to stop that. And I understand that. But you know what? Anybody that has command of the language and understands the vernacular of the day, and that's the problem too. They want to. The language changes as we move forward. See, what we have to use is the original intent. You know, a lot of your medical stuff is written in Latin, and there's a reason for that, because Latin is a dead language, and words don't change meanings. So we have methods of preserving. That's why, like Black's Law Dictionary and that's what they go back to in the language and explaining these different terms. And as long as you have knowledge of that, there's no reason that you should say that there's no law, because it's not true. Those fundamental principles are absolutely true, and I can argue with you from now till the cows come home, and you'll lose, because guess what? You can't convince me that it's okay to murder. You know?
5 minutes.
I agree with you 100%. You're preaching to the choir.
Okay.
I don't want to waste any more time. I just wanted to make it abundantly clear that if you weren't aware of this guy, and maybe you should revisit his page, because It's my understanding that he has just retired 2 months ago.
Okay.
And I don't know what significance that would have.
Right.
So I'm making you aware of that as well.
Hey, John, that guy you're talking about that wanted us to write in a certain way, he had all those words that were color-coded.
Right.
He said, these words are constitutional words, and these words are don't hold to the Constitution. Is that the guy you're talking about?
I'm pretty sure it is the same guy, yes.
Well,
matter of fact, I know it was, because that's what we were. Look at it. It didn't pan out for me in any way. You know?
But he wasn't using mathematics. He was.
There were some kind of equations that he was using, it was called a syntax, right, Fred?
Yes, sir.
It was called.
You can find him on the internet, David Wynn Miller. He's all over the place. Lots of videos.
I'm gonna look at my Skype because I think I had him in my Skype when we were talking back and forth with him.
W-Y-N-N is Wynn, and then Miller, David Wynn Miller.
Actually, we were talking to one of his students, John, his top student. I don't know that we actually talked to him, maybe
okay.
once. But he had a guy that brought it to us, and he was a student of his. Matter of fact, I think I saved some recordings on my computer. I'll have to go back and revisit it. But anyway, which might be a good idea, because a lot of times you gain, after you do all this research, we're constantly researching at NLA, and you pick up knowledge in different areas. And a lot of times you go back and you can make sense out of something that you didn't understand the first time because you didn't have the knowledge that you have now. And that's actually wisdom. When you can connect all the knowledge that you gain, then what happens is you get wisdom. So that's what we're trying to do here. Anyway, I think we'll move on to the next guy.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Fred.
Sorry, I didn't mean to make waves.
No, that's what, we like waves. Otherwise,
don't let it happen again, Fred.
Well, John doesn't like waves. He likes the
I love dolls. Waves. I He's love waves.
Dolls. Yeah, I know you do. Yeah, you cause most of your own, too. Anyway.
I'm a great wave maker, right?
Yeah. All right.
Ollie's back down there, Gerard.
Oh, is he? Can we unmute him real quick? Because I think that's important. I would do it, but I don't see him.
Yeah, I see him. I'll try and do it here in a second.
Okay. Ollie.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing? Somebody mentioned that we hadn't had any updates with the trial out there, and they were wondering if there was anything that we should be brought up on. I think the last big news we had was that Ryan was released, and I don't know exactly what was going on with the hearings and the evidence that, you know, I know Judge Navarro was allowing a lot more stuff. So can you tell us anything on that?
Okay, I'm doing six different things right now. I've got HTML and a lot of other stuff running around this whole mine, but I'll try.
Okay.
But last, Don gave an update at noon, and he hasn't had one at the end of the day yet. But there's what happened this morning. Before the trial came in, for lack of a better term, they had one of their argument sessions. It came out that there's been a female, she's a female prosecutor now, but she's been in the courtroom in every trial, every day, okay? It came out that she used to be an attorney for the Department of Interior. She attended meetings before Bunkerville, and during Bunkerville, she was on the ground working with somebody else. I forget who it was she was working with, but she was on the ground, okay? Now she's a prosecutor, okay? I can't say the word, but that's not right, okay? When that came out, Whipple, Alma's attorney, and I'll tell you what, he is turned that trial upside down. They've got some good attorneys. He got up and he immediately called for dismissal, And he actually said that this was all a setup. And it also came out that, let me think a minute here. It also came out, my mind went blank. That's just my mind. But anyway, more and more is being discovered, and it's dribbling out, okay, by all means that they should be that trial should be wind up in dismissal right now. Okay, that they have been locked up almost 2 years. Extreme psychological abuse and physical abuse in Paul Rump and Henderson both. Okay, when they brought him over to Henderson, they done something, and Henderson got 40 million phone calls that start treating them like humans. So they rejected him, sent him back to Paul Rump, which Paul Rump is something like, I don't know, 50 miles northwest of Vegas, so that's a hardship, just traveling that many miles early in the morning and at night, back and forth daily to a trial. But like I say, that trial, by all means, it should be done. It should be done. It's been proven that the conspiracy charges were nothing but lies from Daniel P. Love at the grand jury. And going in, I told everybody, and everybody knew they did not have a leg to stand on. Their case was built upon lies, hiding evidence, shoving stuff under the rug, and it's all coming out. And I don't expect that trial to go any much farther. But it's getting very interesting. And let me give me just 2 seconds. Jerry Davali come out with a article of day that was spot on. Somebody give a reaction. Let me think a minute. Somebody talk for a minute. Let me think a minute.
Well, go ahead. I'll shut up.
Okay. She come out with an article, and she made this logic. She's on one hand, she made the statement, and I think probably to the jury, that these men are innocent until they are proven guilty. Yet, when it comes to a pretrial release, they are a flight risk. They are anti-government. They are a flight risk. So you got that. You got Navarre herself. She don't know up from down, But like I say, I don't expect this trial to go on much further. It can't. Now you can talk, George.
Well, it makes sense, because I think what's happening is now that there's all these indictments out there, that all those people that were propping up the lie, now Navarro and the other people that are actually doing stuff related to that have no guarantees. They have no safety net. They're out there swinging in the wind, and they're looking to get out of there. That's what I believe, because they understand. Look, this case is falling apart just as Hillary's falling apart in the rest of the country with these indictments. So it all goes hand in hand. So it all helps, and I think that's probably what their problem is. It's not business as usual, and they don't have their normal protections. And they're not used to this. And so they're disheveled, and they're confused, and they're knocked back on their heels. And so, yeah, I could see the thing is falling apart. Look, for that attorney to stand up and demand a dismissal and say that this is all set up, that's a far cry from where we were a year ago, isn't it?
Well, one more comment. See, Meyer, the prosecutor, went into this trial dreaming of a career advancement and all this and that. Well, I think he's come to the stark realization right now that his career is over. It is toast. And I think Navarro is beginning to think the same thing. Their careers are toast. And let me say one more thing. That this trial is important. It's going to set case law. It's going to set precedents for the rest of the century. These people are it is out of their league. They are not qualified to be prosecuting this trial or judging it. It is out of their league, and this trial is very important. And it is dissipating in front of their eyes. And there are some forces there. I guarantee you. That's forcing the truth out, that's bringing the truth out. But I made the statement months ago, this trial is going to ruin careers and it's going to make careers. Well, I'll tell you what, that was a good statement, because that's what's happening right now, and it is just starting. It is just starting.
Okay, thank you, Ollie. That's good.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you later. Okay, all right. Yeah,
just a little correction there. You know, I don't think you could make case law per se, because juries aren't considering or shouldn't be concerned with other court cases other than educational court cases, like Barbary versus Madison, you know, a case like that. But again, they don't need the knowledge of that. Juries need to make their decisions on the facts in front of them and the law as they understand it, and that's pretty much it. They don't work on case law. Now, case law works only when the judges make the decisions. So, just wanted to make that note.
Okay. I have. I think it was Crystal that I unmuted. Are you there, Crystal? That says Crystal. CT for Connecticut. Are you there, Crystal? Well, we must have... must be muted. Going once, going twice. All right, I'm going to take the next one. Crystal, get back in the queue. Okay, we have Paul. Missouri? Yes.
Paul, Michigan.
Oh, Michigan, excuse me.
I got two items. One is information, and the other one I'd like to have ask Brent a question. First one is information. It's a book that I came across. It's called A General Instructor on the Office, Duty, and Authority of Justices of the Peace, Sheriffs, coroners, constables, jurors, and jailers, with precedences. And it also says it's a guide to superior and county court clerks. And it was by John Bradford, 1820. So it's an older book. And it's 450 pages.
Is it still in print?
You can see it. I got an email on it. It's on the internet, yeah. And it's got writs in it and law terms, glossary. So it looks pretty good. I just got it today.
Maybe somebody. You can drop us a link, you know, send it to John or myself or Jan. We're always interested in stuff like that. More
well, it looks like a good book. I didn't get into it yet, but it looks like something the sheriff book we're in the process of writing, that we're probably reinventing the wheel or something here, you know?
Yeah, well, history repeats itself now, doesn't it? Now, this was
yes,
in
it does.
18 what? Was it 18 something you said?
1820.
That's very interesting.
And it's by, it's Princeton University. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, we'd certainly like to look at it, I'm sure.
Okay, I'll ship a link to your way. So.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next.
And also, is Brent still there yet?
I believe he is. Hang on. Anybody see Brent? Hang on. Bear with me a minute as I scroll here.
Well, he's got the ability to unmute himself, so if he's here, Brent, unmute yourself. But let me take an opportunity to ask something. I just thought about this. You know, when people visit the sheriff's page, which is powerofthecountysheriff.org, if you click on law, you'll find a place where we have a lot of state constitutions. If your state constitution is missing, maybe you can send us a PDF copy. You can send it to questions, plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Just attach the PDF to it, and then we'll post it, because we'd like to get all of the state constitutions up there. We're missing quite a few of them. I think we got about, 15 or so up there right now. But Brent, are you here?
He's there, but I can't unmute him for some reason.
Maybe he doesn't want to be unmuted.
I guess not.
Well, he may be away from the computer. So.
What happens when you click on the phone? I'm afraid to do it.
It should. If you click on his phone, click on his mic.
Yeah, the mic's not doing anything.
Oh, okay. Can't help you.
Okay, I won't click on his phone. It's liable to blow his phone up. Okay. All right.
Well, I got the question for one of you guys then, maybe.
Well,
I got an antagonist friend who's always looking at the deepest meaning of a word. Mm-hmm. And, like an Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6 about the president's inability to discharge his duties. Now, this friend takes all those words discharge, and he took them out of Black's Fourth, and is to release, annul, unburden, disencumber, dismiss. So what he's saying is, every time they take an oath of office, they are admitting that they're relinquishing their oath of office. They use the word discharge versus execute. So do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I don't know how that conclusion could be, come to that kind of a conclusion.
Well, the only thing is Black's Fourth.
Yeah, but look at just because Black's Law says something, usually Black's Law takes something out of a court decision and usually gives a reference to that court decision, and you can read it within the context, because words have more than one meaning more often than not. Discharge something has many meanings, and I'm sure our founders weren't interested in confusing us. Look, it is a little tricky the way it was written originally. A lot of it, I think, and I don't know if that would say a lot of it, some of it was changed with the anti-federalist arguments in order to get the Constitution in a good shape, but what really protected us and prevented the abuse of the Constitution was the Bill of Rights. I mean, that was brilliant, and that was from Jefferson working with James Madison on that.
Right. Well, Black's Law is 1951 and revised in 1968.
Right, and there's a later ones than that too, I believe. But
yeah, But I mean, my point is, John, that I go to back to 1828. Noel Webster's dictionary, and he has a lot of different definitions of discharge in there, and that was compiled during the Constitution era, when the Constitution was being. So I refer this my friend back to Webster's 1828. He don't like that. He liked Black's Law. So my question is really to Brent was, did the word mean change over the years?
Well, again, a word has more than one meaning to begin with. If Brent's here, I'm sure he'll respond. But the word has more than one meaning to begin with, okay? And remember, yes. Black's Law deals with, I believe, you know, we did a paper on this, on different, you know, how many laws there are, different types of laws, and I think this Blacks deals with about 20 different laws. You know, so there's different. How would I say? You know, we're interested in common law, and of course, common law is dealt with in blacks also. But again, you got to be careful on how you interpret these things. The intent of the word clearly does not have the intent that you're thinking or that that person is thinking.
I mean, well, I agree with it. I agree with it. Also, this book that I mentioned to you of 1820, it says a common law, refers to the common law. So,
as it should, all right.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, there's a difference between blacks first, second, third, fourth, and you can see the changes in blacks as you go further and further, how changes snuck in.
Yeah, I think the major change is in after four, blacks
right.
edition. But, you know, it takes a long time. I know Thornton was talking about this. It takes a long time to change the meaning of a word, legally speaking. But again, you know, what court are you in when that meaning is changed? And again, if you go back into Black's Law, you'll probably find some reference. If it has to do with, you know, the law of the land, so to speak, our law, they usually would make a quote of a Supreme Court ruling or something. And even if that's the case, again, you get to go read the within context, and then you could see it means something totally different, potentially speaking.
Yeah, like 1828, no election, too. That was compiled when the Constitution was being written. So you would think that that language then was compatible with the Constitution. In fact,
well,
it is.
Again, there was a war of words, there was a war of courts, there was a war of law, and that is the concern. Jefferson was the one that kept it on track. Again, first of all, he made clear note of it in the Declaration of Independence. Secondly, he was behind the Federalist Papers, even though he wasn't, I mean, the Anti-Federalist Papers, and the writing of the Bill of Rights, even though Madison got credit for it, of course, because he was the guy that was making the arguments. But he was communicating with Jefferson, who was out of the country at the time, and Jefferson was his teacher, ultimately speaking. So a lot of these thoughts and ideas come from Jefferson's mind. And remember, Black's Law was covering a lot of laws back then. There were 20 different kinds of courts. And we dealt, you know, again, we wrote a paper. You can find it. It's not sure where exactly it's on our website. Might probably under law somewhere. We wrote a paper concerning laws and, you know, how many different kinds of courts there are. And because, again, Blacks deals with a lot.
Paul makes the point that Noah Webster, you know, wrote that dictionary when the Constitution was being written. Didn't he say he wanted it to lock down the meanings of words? So
yes, he wanted. That's exactly what I heard too. Yep, you're absolutely on point.
So that we shouldn't take away from Noah Webster too. So if that was vernacular of the day, that's a good source to go to when you have a question about a word such as discharge, because Noah put it in there as it was understood in his day.
Right.
Original.
Remember, content controls the whole thing, though.
I understand that. Right. I understand.
Here's a quote.
In a legal document, you know, you're looking where all the commas are and stuff, but...
10 minutes.
As far as what the word means, I don't know. I think it lends credibility to what Noah Webster said it means to the average person in the street. But anyway, we can...
Here's a quote from James Madison. Quick a minute. Do not separate text from historical background. If you do, you will have perverted and subverted the Constitution, which can only end in a distorted, bastardized form of illegitimate government. That was James Madison.
You're absolutely right, and I'm trying to think who it was. I think it was Scalia who made the point, but it might have been other men too. That we ought to go back. Matter of fact, I think he was quoting that we have to go back to the original language and the intent of the writers of it. No, Jefferson said this. He quoted Jefferson that we need to go to the original intent And of course, the argument of the day. And we do that by going into the Federalist Papers. You really want to understand what the Constitution, the intent of the Constitution, go read the Federalist Papers, and then read the Anti-Federalist Papers, and then read the Bill of Rights. And you'll get a clear picture at that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Paul. That was good. Okay, going to go to the next questioner. I don't know who it is. It's a follow-up.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Wait a minute, these people have to understand that the legislation is void. I want to address the issue. This is a free country. There's no law that rules man in this country. If you sign a contract that says you adhere to the laws of the state, then you're bound by those particular statutes unless you claim that you did it under duress. But other than that, this is a free country. And if you look at the 14th Amendment, it strictly states that every one of us that is not either born and naturalized, not just or, but and. The legislative analysis right there points you in the direction that you have to be inclusive, not exclusive, of being born and or naturalized and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Guess what that means? You have no loyalty oath. You're basically a representation. I can say this probably, pretty firmly here, that everyone on the call that's listening has a genuine intent to be basically the people that are in the de jure place to challenge, okay? And, the Ninth Amendment applies directly to all of you, the Ninth, the Tenth Amendment, all of that stuff. Now, with regard to the David Wynn Miller issue and the syntax, by the way, I spoke to David a few weeks ago. His health is not that good, you guys, right now. And he has some issues going on. And there's been people in his circle who have been betraying him, too, from my understanding. But the issue of syntax, there's one thing you guys have to clear up. Syntax was around before David Wynn Miller. He didn't create it. It's part of language. It has to do with the parts of speech and how they, play off of each other. So each word, its meaning, and what it means when you put one word next to another word. That's all it is. They teach it in the first year of law school for all the lawyers, syntax. So David Wynn Miller was exposing this entire area of manipulation that the government is doing, which is why he came out with the quantum grammar, okay, because that's what that does is basically allow people to kind of, if they have the knowledge, to trump some ambiguous claims, right, because each one of you have the knowledge of how to speak English. If you're hearing my voice, you know the parts of speech, and you're not going to deny that the words on the paper mean, that you understand it. Okay, so all I really, want to say is that you can use quantum to create brand new charters, to create county government, which is based basically on population of in the common law. You see, and the idea is, what I've done, see, I'll tell you what, to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and I authenticated I got an ID, right? Okay, so did you know that in that ID there's a consent to the laws of the state? What I did, John and Gerard and everyone else that's listening, was basically signing quantum grammar, right? Because I knew that I was going to be able to make my quantum grammar claim later on down the road, and I would preserve my ambiguity claim. We need that when we're common law, because all of the de facto statutory, John, the statutes, all of the statutes, everything that's Roman civil authority can be trumped by a de jure organization of people that have knowledge of what the words actually mean. This is meaning that we have to form our own charters. It's not enough to form jural societies. We got to end all the adhesion contracts that we have with the state, This way there's no jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, adhesion contract created. There's no presumption of personal jurisdiction. We got to end all those contracts. Then proceed to write charters that establish common law jurisdictions within the particular jurisdiction that you are living in, like the precinct. If you go into the common law, you understand how precincts are typically a part of the common law. So
yeah, Jeremiah, before you go too much further, you know, when you talk about these contracts and stuff, look at if one side is not aware of the contract, any application or of that contract is just a fraud. And so anytime you walk in a court, when an individual is walking into a courtroom believing that they're going to get justice and they get something else, they've been defrauded and a crime has been committed. And so all of these things, you know, is really a kind of a null and void thing. The people just have to take these things back, and that's, of course, what we're trying to do is take the judiciary back, the control of the judiciary, shall I say, or the judicial process, and bring it back to under the common law. But again, when we get into these contracts and things, we don't have to, you know, get too lost in all these things. Matter of fact, here's the bottom line. Understand what an ecprius court is, and then you'll get rid of most of your problems as long as you can avoid that ecprius court or get that ecprius court so tied up that they have to release you. And the simplest way to do that is really just lay out their powers and authority by giving them authority by what they really are. And then when they make a denial and they continue to go forward, stop even arguing in that court. Move it into the federal court for cause and argue the constitutional issue. You know, I just filed papers in the court today, a personal case, and I went down and filed it. And you know, they want to know what the cause is, the cause of action that brings you into a federal court. Well, it's very simple. It's the Constitution. And I quoted specifically.
It's not enough to just say the Constitution gives you authority to answer.
No, it's a constitutional issue. So, and then I quoted exactly where the violations were, but the clerk wasn't satisfied with that, and the clerk said, no, you have to give statutory provision, and he suggested, I was surprised at this, he suggested U.S. Code 42, 1982, I think it is. And I says, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I've got that clearly quoted in my papers. I wrote that up, and that made them happy, and that was okay, too. But again, it's a box they're putting in. We got to stop those things.
Here's how we stop it, okay? We have to basically take all of our adhesion contracts that we have, which show evidence of our conduct by contracting underneath, it's called a consent.
We don't have to get that complex.
Hold on a second. Let me explain myself because you'll understand what I'm saying.
But if you're going to talk about collecting all this knowledge in order to deal with the problem, it's
knowledge. No. John, listen, are you a private man or not?
Well, I'm not even sure how to answer your question on that, you know?
Okay, look. The bottom line is you have the right to choose your form of law that you operate under. Okay.
Well, look at you. You have a right to go into any administrative court you wish. That is true. But when you go into an I'm telling you that you have a right to go into any administrative court you wish. When you're pulled into a court of law for a crime, you don't have a choice of any other court other than that. Of course, you will find yourself in other courts anyway. But look at all of our problems stem with the Nisi Prius courts. What are the Nisi Prius courts, and where are we getting beat up? We get beat up in town courts. We get beat up in
reason. These Nisi Prius courts, which are also known as inferior courts established by Congress,
they're not courts of law. No, they are not. You have to look at. You have to know you're getting into that court, and you have to agree. That's why they call it Nisi Prius, unless first, okay. And that's the trick. That's the trick that they played with.
When we come in as the people under qualified immunity as juries, that destroys all of that crap that you're talking about right there. That's how we do it.
Well,
you have
I don't even understand what you just said. Look, if you think you're going to go into an E.C. Prius court and get a jury, you know, forget about that. That's not going to happen. I mean, if you do get one, because the town courts do sometimes supply them things to make it look good, you'll get five or six clowns that are sitting on the side, well-trained by the judge, and you're going to lose because it's all about statutes. The judge is going to make it clear. Was the person, you know, was he driving without a license or not? Well, he admits he was. You have to obey. Then he tells the jury, you have to convict. It's all, look, we don't belong in those courts.
Well, here's the thing, John. I'm not going to sit here and debate.
10 minutes.
I'm gonna let you get to the other callers that are calling in because I want to respect them. But here's the thing. I'm not going to debate with you about whether or not, you know, statutes, this and that. You know, the only point I want to make is that the status that you have to have as a common law jury member is to not have any consent forms saying you consent to the laws of the state. If you want to represent the du jour people, you have to not have any of these.
I don't consent to the laws of the state. Do you consent to the laws of the state? The laws of the state were made for bureaucrats or commercial activities.
Do you have a driver's license?
Are you asking me if I got a driver's license? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, issued by the state of
California. Oh, I've got a driver's license, yes, because from time to time I drive commercially. So if a cop stops me when I'm not driving commercially, I'm not going to give him a hard time when he asks to see my driver's license. Maybe he just wants to know who I am. I don't know.
Again, and if you look at the bottom of the application for your driver's license, it's actually consent to receive service of process.
Again, if I'm driving commercially.
Hold on a second. They do it with identifications also, you guys. It's all over the place. It's rampant. It's total fraud. It's manipulation of the people's knowledge of the law. It's fucked up with what they're doing, okay?
I apologize.
Mm. What they're doing, they're making...
By the way, we do have children listening, but go ahead.
Kiddos, happy holidays, and I apologize for the vulgar language and the grammar. Let's correct that. The idea, John, is I do not want people to be misunderstood. I want them to be able to have their entire power of the people. And the only way that I can see that will be possible is when they encompass it, they grab a hold of it with a firm grip, by getting rid of adhesion contracts that actually consent to be sued in the courts of the state under those laws. You've got to understand how important contracts
are.
Well,
look it. Here's the problem.
My last point is this, and I'll shut the fuck up. I'll shut up.
Hey.
Is this.
Listen, Jeremiah, please don't make that mistake again.
I'm sorry. Don't understand the laws of the state and you're not a lawyer, it doesn't matter. You can still contract, but your contract is voidable. That is how it works in their system. So do not contract with or to or for to be under the laws of anyone. If you're trying to be a common law jury member, you hear me, people?
99. Put another number in there, of the people have no clue on what's going on in these courts. They don't have a chance when they walk in there. They're expecting to be judged justly. And they're believing that they're breaking laws when they're called in there because maybe I was driving without a license or something. You know, they're believing these things, and it's all unjust. The 1%, less than 1% that understands this has to battle it from a different perspective than playing in a sandbox. And we got to get them for fraud on the court because that's what it is.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. On this call, I bet you money that 90 to 95% of the people understand what we're talking about with no problems.
On this call, yes.
All right, that's what I'm talking to.
Well, and again, that's less than 1% of the people, period. Less than 1%.
So what about the quantum grammar, though? Talk about that unless you want to get to another call.
Yeah, why don't you get back into the queue? It's not. I don't think there's many people in there. And let's give someone else a chance.
Yeah, cool, man. Hey, thanks a lot, you guys.
Watch your lingo when you come back, though.
Okay. I'm going to look at, I want to catch Eric because he's been in and out of there twice and we've missed him. Go ahead, Eric. You've been unmuted.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Okay. Jeremiah, I think he dropped the second F-bomb just to be defiant. So I don't appreciate that. Also, I'm going to go ahead and tell you that it's my opinion after listening to Jeremiah for so long, he is incorrigible. It doesn't matter what you sign if you sign your driver's license. It's like John says, it's a really good form of ID. Most of us had no idea that we were somehow giving away our consent or agreeing to adhesion contracts. And it's like John says, if we're not aware of the contract, then it's null and void. There has to be full disclosure. And so however long it takes, and you know, I think Terry's good at keeping track of how long things go, but however long you talk to Jeremiah, it doesn't matter. He refuses to accept the fact that these contracts are null and void because there's not full disclosure. So you can sort of every argument, and John tried to say that, and John's tried to been saying he's tried to say it. For a year and a half, Jeremiah, but the point is the employees in court. I just think he can't get past his perspective. Several times when I thought he was going to get it, I thought he didn't get it. But there's something about it. He wants to give away his power to the state. And I think, you know, this might sound like a psychological profile, but I think what there is there's a, you know, and I could be wrong here, but there's a seed, there's an egoic seed. It's a seed in his mind. John's talked about this before. It's a perspective. People that have been studying this law for so long, they just can't get their head around the fact that this law is actually just a bunch of hooey. It's administrative law, and it doesn't apply to us. We've been studying it for so long. And when you look at the lawyers in the world, or here in America, they have so much money behind them, and they went to school. And Jeremiah, you know, in a contemptuous way, he said, "What school did you go to?" I remember him saying that in a conversation. That you went to the school of hard knocks, but you didn't go to a law school. Okay, you didn't pay over $100,000. You don't have a real nice car. I'm assuming you don't have a bigger house than your neighbor. Okay, you don't have real linen that you wear. You don't have a bespoke suit. All this stuff.
Hey, Eric, you're really breaking up bad. I don't know why. I'm getting like every third word of yours.
Ah, well, that's a shame.
Oh, there you go. I don't know what you did. All of a sudden, you came in clear. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think we got the gist of it, though. It wasn't that he was. I got most of what he said, but he is breaking a little bit. But let me just make a point here. They have boxed this in everywhere. When you go fill the paper out for a federal case or even a state case, especially in New York now, they've moved to this electronic connection, and you don't get a person that you can hold liable directly. You don't even get a name. And they can reject this or reject that. They require you to do this box or that box. Like requiring me to put a statute as a cause is just it's so unconstitutional. It's pathetic. And so that's a problem there. But they've got us everywhere. The $400 you got to pay to get into the court. Again, all of this changes and puts us into the wrong jurisdiction where we don't want to be. But, you know, you could do all these things and check those boxes and do what the clerk tells you and then get in and change it in front of the judge and make it clear. This is a court of record. I'm in an Article III court. I do that through memorandums. And every federal case that I file, I make sure they have a memorandum of what an Article III court is. If they don't know, I'm going to tell them. And that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Excellent. Also, the whole syntax argument. John, you've answered this before as well, and it's real simple. Here's your syntax argument. God has written in our hearts his law. So here's your syntax. Gerard said the same thing. Murder is murder. I don't care where the adverb or the verb is. So we don't. And Brent makes this point all the time. We don't need to make things complex. They're real simple. Anyway, obviously I agree with you, but you know, I think there's just there's a perspective that Jeremiah, it just seems that he's incorrigible.
Are you coming in on a mic, Eric, or a phone?
This is a phone, and I took it off speaker, so it should be, what, am I breaking up again? It's probably
well,
just,
it's coming up and down, in and out, low, but I mean, I'm getting you all, so.
Okay. Well, yeah, anyway, I'm still rooting for Jeremiah. I want him to get, I thought he was going to surprise me because I used the word incorrigible, and there's several times over the past year and a half or however long he's been coming on where I thought he was going to surprise me and get past this perspective, but it's real simple, like you and Gerard and Brent always say. It's not complex. It's written in your heart.
It's all about jurisdiction and due process. That's the question you ask yourself anytime you get involved with anything. What is the jurisdiction? Am I getting due process in this process? And if you're not in the paper part of it or the beginning part of it or whatever part of it, at some point you bring it up early in the court. You bring up the issue, write memorandums, make it clear, and then prosecute it that way. And that's all you can do. And again, look at when the judge turns around, if you're in a court where the judge is trying to take control, first of all, if you're in a court of record, there are no such things as summary judgments with the exception of a default or something so obvious it's ridiculous that this case shouldn't even be here and it's discharged. I'll use that word.
5 minutes.
For me? Just kidding. I kind of lost my train of thought after that. But, you know, we just got to watch for jurisdiction. We got to watch for due process and make sure you're getting it. And in my opinion, it took me a while to come to this kind of a conclusion because I was trying to figure out how to deal with the courts. And you always, every time you write a paper, you got to, you know, put all this stuff in there and you got to get this and that. And I realize now you make note of all of these different issues and refer to a memorandum. And you control everything by memorandums as far as what kind of court you're in and what is the jurisdiction and what the expectation is in due process by the empowerment of the Bill of Rights. And all
okay.
of these, by the way, we've got all these memorandums up online. People can download them and use them on their cases.
Yeah, your footnotes are, well, in my opinion, it's a layman's opinion, are superb. They're wonderful. I use them as often as possible. I don't go into a court, but anyway, a summary judgment is only to be used in certain cases. It's certainly not to be used when both parties are there in a criminal case. Okay, so yeah, that makes plenty of sense. You've explained it well over time. But here's a question that I do have. In a common law court of record, does the magistrate have the power to hold someone in contempt, or does the jury? Because in an inferior court, they have no power to hold for contempt or fine, right? But does the magistrate have the power to hold someone?
Well, I would believe the suggestion is it's yes because of that, and the judge does have to have the power and the authority in his court, but it's abused, obviously, and that is the problem. That's why I don't like it. But you can't not allow that power or authority of the judge or the magistrate in that court. When someone is out of order, they're out of order, and it has to be stopped. But, again, they abuse it all the time. I think once we get back to common law grand juries, once we get back to at least the people who are the law enforcers, particularly the sheriffs and the marshals, who understand the law, and we get our law and we get our due process, I think all and we got our common law grand juries where we can now go and indict judges that are in bad behavior to get them out of office since the legislators won't do that. And I think the president can't do that, by the way. I think I heard someone say about the president doing firing a judge. A president can't fire a judge if he appointed the judge. That's clear in Marbury versus Madison. And rightly so. You can't have a judge controlled by an individual. They gotta be, you know, directly relating their own understanding to how they understand the law or the Constitution and so on. But anybody using any kind of sane logic will come to the same conclusion that everyone else that is using sane logic will come to. When you get something distorted, of course, that becomes the problem. But the way we could deal with these people today, again, when you get a distortment, and I wish I realized this earlier on, but I know it now, and you utilize it now, go after the judge. Take the judge down. Look at when it's so obvious on paper what that individual is doing, when you kind of step back and say, what? Well, then you write, you do a writ of error, and then you go after the judge, literally bring them into the case, or you open another case for cause, off of, that springs off of that case, of course, and deal with him for fraud on the court, because fraud on the court is committed only by officers of the court. They're the only ones that can commit fraud on the court. You know, other people, they'd be lying in the court or other things, but you know, judges commit fraud on the court.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I never thought about the parameter, but only officers of the court can put fraud on the court. Okay. Also, here's one more thing, just real quick. You brought up this idea before, and it's been some time, I think, since I heard you say it. But I want to tell you that I agree with you 100%. Oh yeah. So if they misuse the contempt of court, which they do all the time, they abuse the heck out of it. So what it does is it chills our side. It chills us because none of us want to be tossed in a cell. So it's like they block justice. They stop justice from occurring when they do that. But like you were saying once, and you said it many times, we don't really need the judge. We could have the coroner. We could have the sheriff. Run that court. And I just wanted to say, after thinking about when you said that, after thinking about it for some time, I think if we use history or historical fact or truth, we have a real good argument that the position of a judge, especially a federal judge, is too much power for frail man to handle. And that might sound real radical, but if you look at the history and all the facts here, I think it's just too much doggone power for any one human being.
Look at Jefferson. Jefferson was concerned of this. He didn't trust judges. A lot of people are concerned with this, and I believe the problem can be solved if we can achieve our goal here at National Liberty Alliance by working and creating these administrations for the grand jury and common law grand jury, of course, and the trial jury, and get them in every county and take this power away from the judge. Now we have something we can hold the judge accountable on. And then now, what are they governed by now? They're governed by either obeying the law themselves, okay, which they should know, and if they don't, it'll become obvious, and you've got to get rid of them. They're in bad behavior. But generally speaking, they'll do the right thing because of fear of being judged in some way themselves. In other words, we can indict them. But without that fear of indictment or impeachment or removal from office for bad behavior, which would be impeachment, without that fear, which they have no fear of because it doesn't exist for them, it doesn't happen. Put that fear back into the play here, and then we'll control these people. Now we can trust their judgments, okay, because they'll be judged if they commit fraud on the court. And again, look, it is, in my opinion, any case that I have seen where the abuse of the court is by the judge, it just is so crystal clear. You can't hide it. It's nobody in their right mind would deny it. Okay, the only ones that would deny it is the ones that are in the game with them. They're part of the problem, and they're expecting, a wink, a nod, and a handshake. They're expecting to get their way when it's their turn, and that's the problem. But we can fix that. We get common law grand juries, administrators for the common law grand juries and trial juries. We get them in every county, and on top of that, teach the sheriffs what they need to know. We take it back, and we can now go into a court and trust a decision of a judge. Because if he doesn't do the right thing, we'll get him for fraud on the court. And, you know, administrators will have enough experience to see that clearly if the individual in the court is unable to see it. We need to monitor the courts. We need to get volunteers to monitor the courts. At the same time, you know, people who are learning law, one of the best things to do is go sit in the courtroom when you're learning law, you know. Of course, it would bore me to tears with the way law is run today, of course. But if we had law running right, you can get an education in the court. But it's not happening. No. But we'll get it there. We're going to get it there.
14
all right, thank
minutes.
I appreciate it, and I'll end with that. And then you're right, though. When you said we got to monitor the courts, we're going to need help with that. We'll have to figure that out. We'll have to figure out how to monitor it because we can't
well,
be everywhere.
Well, look, at, you know, again, we've got the courtroom observers, okay? We're going to continue that. We need to, encourage people to step up. But look, you'll get complaints from the people, and when you examine the complaints and read the hearings, what's going on in the court, you know, whatever record of the court is there, you can see it, you know?
Okay.
So the attention could be brought to the administrators, and the administrators could look into it and deal with it, you know?
Excellent. Okay. All right, thank you.
Gerard.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to bring up our next questioner. Is Felicia. Hi, Felicia. How's it going?
It's going okay. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Awesome. I just wanted to know if... Judge Kahn, has anything been done about that?
No, John was discussing that earlier, that we have to send him a show cause.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we're going to do something with a paper with him. I forget exactly what it was, but definitely we want to deal with the magistrate of the court, too, who's been extremely silent and should be stepping up for what is right. And that's it. You know, look, they don't even understand the purpose of a magistrate and a judge. I was in the federal court today, and when I got all my papers walking out, and they've never shown me this before, I've never seen this before, but there was appointed to my case a magistrate and a judge, you know? I didn't want to talk or question anything about that. First of all, no judge belongs in my case because I'm in a court of record, so I don't want a judge. But I don't know what they're thinking. What is that all about? I don't even understand the logic behind that kind of thinking. You know, look, at a magistrate, all judges are magistrates to begin with, so any judge can sit in the courtroom and exercise the duties of a magistrate, and that's what they need to do when they're in a court of record. But a judge can also, of course, the judges in the other side of the court, when the judge gets in there and makes the decision. We submit to that. We decide in a contract case or something like that. That's fine. But a magistrate cannot sit in a common law court because cannot judge as in a court where a judge should be sitting. A magistrate cannot sit in that place. Only in a court of record would a magistrate be. So again, I don't understand how they're thinking this out and why they're appointing two different individuals that have two different purposes ultimately.
Because
they appointed two different people to do a non-judicial foreclosure on my house.
Well, now you got two people to go after, don't you?
Yeah, and then on top of that, you know,
double
I want to get the deed. I got a copy of the deed, and it was a special deed, and the name was whited out.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, wow, this is public records.
Yeah, look, it's pretty bad, and you look on the dockets sometimes, they're all out of whack, the numbers are all out of place, the dates, it's really a mess. And that, look at the purpose of a docket, for instance, everything is numbered and dated and happens in order so people don't mess around with the records. That's the point of that. But they're messing around with the records.
Yes, sir, they are. But that was my only question.
But let me be a little more clearer on the courts, you know, in equity courts. I should have made that point. It's an equity court where a judge sits, okay, and a magistrate cannot sit in an equity court. And in a court of record, okay, a magistrate must sit in that court. And a judge is a magistrate. He has to wear a different hat.
Okay. I understand that clearly.
So obviously they understand that, John, because they're making provisions to have a judge and a magistrate, depending on where they can make you step. So you've been educating them.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We're going to see how it goes when we get in there. Hopefully I'll never have to go see them. I don't anticipate going to see them because I anticipate getting a summary judgment for a default.
I can't wait for that because they made my life a living hell.
It made a
lot.
Well,
you know, if you've got the ability, you want to take your case number and move it into the federal court for cause.
Well, I submitted it in the local court for show cause.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not going to go anywhere. Look, you gotta get outside of their system at this point. If you're being abused, what level are you on? You're on a town level? County level? You know, what court?
It's county.
County court.
Lake
okay.
County.
And that's where, in Connecticut?
Florida,
I'm sorry.
Where's not cold.
Okay, so I don't know how it works in Florida. Look into the Florida Constitution and see if the county courts are courts of records. They probably are, and that's fine. But you don't want to move it into a state court. You want to move it into a federal court because, remember, when they abuse you, it's always an unalienable right that they abuse. And when they make that abuse upon you with that by violating your right, that now becomes the jurisdiction of the federal court. A state court can't make any decisions on that. Now they will try because they're going to protect their people, you know. So you're not going to win. You're not going to go nowhere. They'll figure you brought in here and you don't know any better. We'll rule on it for you. I really
don't know. I'm learning, and it's exactly what they did. And I even gave the documents to the sheriff, and even sent it to him, certified mail, and they still put me out.
Right.
Five
well,
minutes.
Look, you can get back in. There's no statutory, what do they call that?
Limitations. No,
yeah,
statutes
of limitations on any case. As long as it's not too old where, everybody's died or all the evidence is gone, that's the only thing that makes a case unexecutable,
Yes, sir. Okay, I don't want to take up too much time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Felicia.
Thank you, sir.
All right, I'm going to go to the next question. Hey, John, put the eight ball in that corner pocket for me, buddy.
You hear it. Is that Is that? I meant that I should. Maybe I should mute, huh? But you know what? I am shooting the eight ball in the corner pocket.
There you go. See, I know.
God's honest truth.
I got Jim on Skype. He says, I heard you shooting the whole time. And Jim goes, I hear John shooting bull. Where do you think he gets his inspiration from? Anyway, I'm going to bring Jim in, speaking of the devil. Go ahead, Jim. You got a couple seconds or minutes left. I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay.
How's it going from the great state of confusion up here in New York? Yep. Yeah, that was pretty cool, the eight in the corner pocket. All right, so...
God, that is truth. That was happening at that moment. I was wondering if he's got his cameras on or something. I don't know.
No. I
know the sound of your ball.
I know the clack when I hear it.
You know the different sound between the four and the eight, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
No, you broke the rack. You broke the rack. Anyway,
I got to get my son a pair of glasses. He keeps missing the point here on the rack.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you're such a hard guy to get a hold of. I wanted to remind you to send me those default sort of foreclosures so I can start filling them out. You said you were going to dig.
Oh, yeah, have we, goodness, I've been so busy with so many things. And
I know, so I got to keep on. Greasy wheel gets the grease.
I apologize.
You know?
Let's try to connect. Goodness, this week's a bad week because we're here on
the holiday.
Oh, yeah,
let's wait
week,
till
you know?
After. You know, I just keep on.
Yeah, let's play catch up and find out where we're at. Do we have many cases laying around?
Oh, we got most of these are ready for default. They're ready to at least get sent out.
Yeah,
for,
but well, default is something we need to move on that. But I mean, what about any new cases? Any new cases coming up?
I got one right on me that gentleman just finished his constitution course today, so I'm going to start doing the papers.
All right, let's. We need to remember only the civics course is required to be completed working on the constitutional course. So.
Yep, he's done with it.
I mean, working on the civics course. I mean.
So, another thing, I don't know. I talked to Mr. Bill today about that fundraising. And he says that it looks like it could be a go. I mean, as far as setting up a nonprofit, I don't know if this is the time to talk about it, but he said it.
Yeah, let's talk it privately because I don't want to deal anything with nonprofit. You know, I'll do, trusts, but it's not registered with the thieves, you know.
Well, he said he was going to get something written up, and then he'd give it to me, and then we'll talk about it.
Like all right.
First week in December or something, you know.
Right.
And it's really no rush. But he mentioned it to me today, so I wanted to kind of put it out there. But other than that, no. It's all good. I would like to see us do something with the federal case, but, you know, everything in due time, you know.
Right. Well, it's moving, and it's not moving according to our pace. I mean, what we want to do and what we can do are two different things. So, we got someone else controlling this.
The thing is, everything's more important than everything else.
Yeah.
Where do you start? You know.
At the beginning. So yeah. I understand.
All right. Well, that's all I had. So,
okay. Well, we're at the end of our rope here. I mean, we're at the end of our time.
Okay.
And we could go ahead and close it up. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming. And God bless, and we'll see you here same time next Monday.
Good night.
Good night.